Finance and Revenue Committee to order.
The House Revenue Committee will come to order. And let me introduce a guest that I have today, Anders Van Zandt, who is a student at the Central Lynn High School. One of his assignments is a job shadow, and he's decided to come to our committee meeting this morning, so he will learn all about state government finance in the next 3 hours or so. Madam Chair?
Mr. Chair, why don't you take over the revenue?
Oh, okay. Very good. Agenda? We do. We do have an agenda. 9 o'clock, we're supposed to hear about the release of the December economic and revenue forecast. Gentlemen?
With clear interpretation.
And we, may I say that we hope it's boring.
Yes.
Very boring.
We can promise you that.
No, excuse me, not your presentation, but the forecast itself.
Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Dave Back, acting state economist. Here with me is senior economist Michael Kennedy of the Office of Economic Analysis. We are here today to present to you the December forecast, the assumptions behind our forecast, and what the forecast looks like. It is true that we have a rather turbulent economy, but we're pleased to be here to tell you that actuals are coming in very close to our forecast. So, having said that, our forecast process is reviewed by different committees and advisory committees, but in the end, we are the ones who are responsible for our forecast. What are the assumptions that we used for September forecast? We said that consumers would relent and business spending will resume and stay healthy, and global expansion would continue. But we saw anemic expansion ahead of us. And personal income growth will be subdued, reflecting subdued employment growth. All in all, we said that we don't see a recession, and we're going to have slower job gains. Looking at recent developments, we see that recent developments are in line with our September forecast. We continue to see spillovers from U.S. housing market and subprime mortgage mess. And starting from August, we had credit crunch in the global economy, and we had ensuing financial instability. But we saw central banks actively intervening. The one thing that we didn't see, although we said that oil prices will remain high, we didn't see record oil prices. And at this point, gasoline prices are rising. Another thing we didn't see, although should have been expected, is that the huge write-downs at financial institutions here and abroad. Recent economic facts in Oregon, well, we still see stable unemployment rate, inched up a little in October, but we see stable initial unemployment benefit claims. So currently, the weak job growth is characterized by not layoffs, but weak hiring activities. We see flat job growth. In the last quarter, we saw a decline, actually, a minor decline, minimal decline of 0.3% in jobs, quarter over quarter, but year over year, it's still up 0.9%. What happened in the third quarter was slightly weaker than our forecast of just flat growth. Personal income growth is still strong, so if you look at what it happens these days in Oregon, two coincident indicators, jobs, very weak, doesn't mean we're shedding ton of jobs, we just don't have job growth. But if you look at personal income growth, it's still strong. So we don't characterize Oregon's economy as either in recession or about to have any recession. Housing starts, of course, tumbled in the third quarter, continuing weakness year over year. It's down about 15 to 20% everywhere in Oregon. The only saving grace in housing sector was a house price appreciation. At this point, we're not seeing double-digit gains like we saw in the past 3 years. But still, we see house price appreciation. Due to high inventories, we continue to see house prices weakening, but we don't predict decline in house prices in Oregon. Because we are exposed to the national economy and the international economy, we have to look at what's happening in the national economy and in the global economy. So we're going to take a look at U.S. economic forecast provided by the Global Insight, our national forecast provider. It's going to say that housing sector recession continues and consumers are finally relenting and business turning cautious. And this is a new development. No let up in global expansion. Robust global economy and weak dollar will help our exports, and that's going to partly offset whatever slowdown we have in domestic demand. All in all, we're going to see subpar growth in 2007 and 2008 before we rebound in 2009. So if you look at real GDP growth, you see below trend growth in 2007 and 2008. And if you look at consumption in 2007, it's still strong, but you see substantial slowdown. And remember that about two-thirds of the U.S. economy is led by consumer spending. As you see in the residential investment, huge negatives. Again, we see a little concerning development in business fixed investment. Businesses are turning cautious because of all kinds of uncertainties surrounding the economy. So we're going to see a slowdown in business investment in 2008. If you look at the last two lines, exports is setting records. And because of weaker economy in the U.S., we're importing a lot less than before. So between the two, our trade balance is improving.
Could I interrupt for just 1 second, make certain I understand these numbers? When you say percent change, are you talking about the actual growth rate or the change in the growth rate?
Actually, the level is declining, which means in terms of residential development, the housing starts tumbled.
Okay. So -16.8 is a reference to the actual
barely
percentage reduction in new housing starts.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
This is global economic expansion. The blue line, blue bar, shows real GDP growth. And we consider 3 and 3.5% as global trend growth. It's averaging that. And particularly industrial production is doing very well, and that bodes very well for our export and manufacturing sector. As I mentioned before, strong global economy and weakening U.S. dollar are promoting our exports. And these two lines show our relative strength of dollars against industrialized countries and developing countries. The value of dollar has been declining for about 5 years, and that's helping our export sector. Assumptions for our December forecast. I'm sure you have some comments on this, these assumptions, this set of assumptions. But we see limited spillover of financial market turmoil to other segments of the economy. We saw, and it's happening, consumers are cutting back on spending, and uncertainty is holding back businesses. They're being very cautious about their business investment spending at this point. Export sector, which explains about 10 to 12% of the total economy here, is partly offsetting slower domestic demand. Again, consumer spending explains about two-thirds of the economy. So export sector alone cannot lead the economy. And because of slower consumer spending, because of continued recession in housing sector, 2008 will be slow, but the Global Insight, our national forecast provider, doesn't see a national recession. Based on these assumptions, we came to the conclusion that 2007, with about 3 months remaining in our data, we predict that there will be 1.2% job growth. But that's a little deceiving because all the jobs that we created in 2007 came in the first half of the year. At this point, for about 3-4 months, we're not seeing any job gains. And that weakness will continue in the very first couple of months of next year. So if we see any growth in 2008, it's all because of stronger 2008, the second half of 2008. And with the improving economy, national economy, we're going to improve in 2009. And since then, after that, we're going to average about trend growth of 1.5, 1.6% growth. Personal income growth will reflect employment growth. We had a huge revision in personal income statistics. We have no control over our history even. Bureau of Economic Analysis at Commerce Department revised our history, and we have to just run with them. 2004 and 2005, actually, the statistics that BEA gives us tells us that we didn't do well. And 2006, we finally did very, very well. But if you look at revision history, I see a possibility of these statistics being revised again. We're not really bad in 2005. So 2007, we had a little bit of strength coming in the first half, although second half will be much weaker. We're going to have 6.2% personal income growth, but we'll be slower in 2008 with 5.4% growth in personal income. And we're going to have a better year in 2009.
Excuse me, this is probably not the time, but it might be useful later to get some sense as to what the Bureau's done and what the effect has been on Oregon. Well, I don't think now's the right time. Let's go ahead with this.
Yes. Well, actually, this pessimistic scenario, I mean, speaks for themselves. Deeper housing downturn and sharply declining house prices. These are the assumptions underlying our pessimistic scenario. And spillover of credit crunch continues, and there is global contagion of financial instability. Soaring oil prices and gasoline prices, and sharply higher inflation. And to fight inflation, the Fed increases interest rate. And because of rising interest rates, the stock market crashes, and consumer confidence suffers, along with business confidence. And consumer spending tanks. And what's the consequence? And if you look at pessimistic scenario, we may actually see a recession in Oregon. And because of weakness in 2008, we're going to see a slower growth in 2009. Your handout doesn't show baseline personal income growth as 6.2. Rather, it would show 6.4. Apologize for the mistake. We corrected. And baseline personal income forecast should have read 6.2% for 2007 and 5.4 and 5.8 next 2 years. And pessimistic scenario, if you look at 2008, we have 3.6% personal income growth, which reflects really weak employment gains together with other changes in personal income components. By the way, Michael will talk to you about revenue forecast, and we always bring in BEA statistics and run with them. What happened was there were some changes in the components in various personal income categories. So what that meant us was to revise some of the forecasts for different components. And if the forecast is calm, doesn't mean all the components stayed calm. Rather, there were like offsetting changes behind the statistics. But Michael will talk to you about December revenue forecast. I can answer your questions at this point, or we can entertain your questions later on.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Beck, I noticed that your pessimistic scenario here does not entertain a reluctance on the international community to continue to finance U.S. debt. Do you see any downside risk there?
Representative Witt and Chairs, yes, there is a big risk there. At one point, the foreign investors may dump dollars, creating huge financial crisis here in this country. And right at this point, Actually, a lot of countries, especially central banks, are diversifying their foreign currency and foreign asset holdings. If foreign investors dump dollars at the same time, what that means is that will add pressure on our interest rate, and that will push up interest rate, because if foreign investors do not finance our spending, that means we have to finance our spending domestically with a limited money available, with limited credit available. That means higher interest rates. So there is a downside risk. Thanks for pointing that out.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you've alluded to the fact that there has been some definitional changes. I just want to make sure that the definition of personal growth for 2006, as it was revised up to 7.3%, did not include the inclusion of normal capital gains. Is that correct? Still correct?
Representative Butler and Chairs, yes, that's correct.
Senator Burt?
You know, we've all been aware of the housing market issues, but I heard on the way down NPR had a piece on there's kind of a mini boom going on in apartment construction, which is actually causing construction figures to rise. And if that does turn out to be a bubble, and I know it's happening here in Oregon as well as nationally, what impact did you look at that particular phenomenon, and what impact would that have if that does indeed turn out to be a bubble?
Chair Burdick, yes, one of the concerns we have is housing sector. There is no question about that. And what happened in October figure, the news that you heard about, apartment units. It is true that we have a little bit of rebound in that sector. On the other hand, if you look at the overall residential sector, the recession is still very, very severe. If you look at condominium segment, we are having a lot of problems too. What happened is when condominiums are not selling, they convert these condominium units for rent. So there will be a little more supplies of apartment. What that means is there, as there is less demand for houses, and as those people who are having trouble paying mortgage, they will look to apartment, and so there is a little bump up in demand for housing, and there is a little more construction of apartment. But overall, the housing sector is continuing in recession, and actually in our forecast, we're forecasting altogether in residential housing, housing starts will decline about 17% this year altogether, and another 10% or so next year. So we can't just look at just one segment of residential sector. We have to look at the totality of it. Yes.
Okay, so to follow up, Mr. Chair, so you see this as kind of an internal adjustment rather than a bubble that might have consequences?
Chair Burdick, yes, that's how we look at it.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, back on the decline in the value of the dollar, first of all, do you see that decline continuing versus other major currencies? And it strikes me that in order to encourage China and others that have been buying our bonds and that have been subsidizing our deficit spending, to encourage them to continue to do that with the declining value of the dollar, the interest rates are going to have to go up. They're going to have to realize a greater take, or they're going to do, as you suggested could happen, dump dollars, in which case our domestic interest rates are going to come under tremendous pressure because we're going to have to try and sell those bonds in our economy, which would be very difficult. How do you see this thing sorting out? I mean, it really troubles me. It really does.
Sarah Monroe and Chairs. Yes, we have a problem in dollar. And how is it going to be resolved? The most economists would agree at this point that the weakness of dollar is quite understandable, considering high current account deficit still, and because of weakening U.S. economy relative to Eurozone and Asia. So behind this weak dollar, there is enough reason for that. On the other hand, as Treasury Secretary mentioned, that strong dollar is in our interest. Now, I don't know if sending that message is enough at this point, or if active market intervention is needed to prop up the value of the dollar. But as it stands, we see the value of dollar continuing to weaken a little bit more. And whether it for how long, probably through the end of next year, but then when dollar is considered to be oversold, probably that's when things will turn around. But for us, for our economy at this point, weak dollar is in our interest. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to contrast a very smart person in Hank Paulson, but I strongly believe that weak dollar is in our interest, especially for our manufacturing. And whatever asset value loss that foreign investors have in our country because of weak dollar, I wouldn't care less.
Representative Butler.
Just one further question, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. One item always concerns me, and that is when business stops investing in capital equipment, and that downturn shows from 3.8 down to 2.4. That's a halving of the amount that they would be investing in a decrease. Now, is that strictly U.S. equipment, or is some of that going into other kinds of things that would not portend new jobs in the United States? And give us a take on this serious downturn in capital investing by businesses.
Representative Butler, Chairs, this slowdown in business spending is a big concern for us. And if you look at the details of slowdown in business spending, actually what happened was the spending on computer and electronic equipment stayed relatively stable or holding up. And spending on metals and machinery also are holding up. And these are the two sectors that are very important for our manufacturing. There is a little bit of good news, at least for us. On the other hand, this uncertainty surrounding the whole economy is just killing the business confidence. Now, of course, we need a strong support from business spending. We need strong support from export. These are the two things that actually are leading the economy at this point. So we will have to continue to watch what what's happening in our business spending. Now, there is also a consideration that whatever business spending is not occurring in domestically may be happening overseas, so that there will be continued demand for our capital goods. And if that's happening, that's a good news for us, because then we will continue to export our capital goods. But domestically, there's no question that businesses are cutting back on their capital spending, and that is a concern for us.
Thank you very much. Why don't we go ahead to the next section?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of both committees. For the record, Michael Kennedy, senior economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. Some point here, a revenue forecast overview, and the chair asks, therefore we shall deliver. It's boring. But first, let's look sort of at the how the forecast is tracking since September, and these numbers here, you've got the September forecast and then the actual collections over the period August, November. The last actual in the September forecast was July. And these actually look like fairly big numbers, but in the context of actually a $14 billion budget, they're fairly small and they're offsetting. But I wanted to talk about them in particular, withholding down $28 million relative to the forecast. That's actually all in September. September had the fewest business days that September can have, and it's just an isolated, it's a trading day influence. Otherwise, our assumptions regarding withholding have been tracking perfectly, surprisingly, at about flat year-over-year growth, and that flat doesn't seem consistent with what we just heard about personal income growth. That's because the withholding tables, again, were changed for 2007, so that flat is actually consistent with about a 7% increase in underlying wages and salaries. So fairly strong actual performance in the economy, even though you've seen employment kind of come to a screeching halt. Estimated payments, I'm going to skip that a second because there's one issue here you need to focus on, and that's really a product of that, and that's right here. This seeming jump up in refunds this year during the extension filing season. And what appears to be going on, it's one of two things. Either, as we noticed back in April, that tax returns were processing so much faster because of the new processing system, iTax. And we had noticed that refunds were flying out the door in March that would usually have gone out in April. Part of that is going on here. The other issue that I think is going on operationally is that the Department of Revenue is attempting to get as many 06 returns completed and processed so that they're available then for the bulk, for the batch kicker processing run. Kickers are processed based upon your 06 return. So it appears that they're attempting in their mission to, you know, serve their customers, the taxpayer, you know, get as many of those kicker checks out on time, and that appears to have accelerated and bumped up these refunds. Well, extension filers, for the most part, or not for the most part, but a lot of them, then tend to just check the box and have their refund applied forward. So these both seem to be, at least in part, consistent with that phenomenon. It's an operational issue, not an underlying structural issue having to do with the economy and having to do with taxable incomes and tax liability, etc. So when you get down bottom line and we analyze these things, you know, by tax year and look at our existing assumptions, we really see no reason to change the assumptions we've got going forward. Things are tracking quite nicely, and you'll see the impact here on the revenue forecast, which is minimal. Moving on to corporate, much the same thing, pretty much temporal. Corporate's got a lot more temporal shifting going on, just noise. I think the thing we've been focusing on right here is that advance payments are coming in pretty much on target with what we had been saying, which means that basically our 2007 tax liability and corporate profits assumptions, again, seem to be holding up and seem to make sense. So, again, no real reason to sort of change the forecast substantially, as we still see. So moving on to the 0709 general fund revenue forecast, we'll see that personal income tax is up $27.8 million which I guess to a human being, 27.8 million sounds like a lot. It's actually 2/1,000ths of a percent revision, so just to keep it in context. And it's really just a function of those estimated payments still being slightly higher, so some indication that non-wage income is a little higher than what we had factored into the forecast. Corporate income tax revision up $400,000. And actually, the September forecast compared to the closed session forecast was down $300,000. Mm-hmm. So we're now $100,000 different from the closed session forecast, which, if it pans out, would be pretty amazing. Of course, that's 5 months out of 24, and as we know, anything can happen. But still, I almost had to go back and check. Is that a misprint? No, it's, you know, we appear to be tracking along quite nicely, subject, obviously, to corporate income tax underlying volatility. Other revenues, there's a mishmash here. Inheritance tax came in the first quarter considerably above the pace we had projected for the entire year. So we've had to make some upward revisions there, modest upward revisions, and interest earnings. We developed a new model to project interest earnings once we started encountering these issues with tax anticipation notes and now with the rainy day fund. And just in the initial stages, the first few months, our interest earnings had come in, you know, about $1 million or maybe $500,000 per month below what we had projected. So we revised those down. We're still sort of in the fledgling stage of actually forecasting those interest earnings, now that they're a lot more volatile than they used to be. So, but the bottom line is a $22 million increase in the revenue forecast. Pretty negligible, and thus $22 million increase in the projected ending balance, which is $206.6 million at this point. I can see by the looks that...
We're bored.
Bored is good.
Well, considering the alternatives, board is very good.
Mr. Chair, I've been there. I've seen those looks.
A lot of us
board is good. So just looking at the kicker, kicker checks are going out now, but hey, let's turn around and look 2 years hence and say, are we forecasting a kicker? Well, right now, the all non-corporate income or non-corporate revenues are up from the closed session forecast by $115.8 million. The actual 2% threshold is 241.4. This is primarily just the decrease in the kicker from what we had factored in the May forecast. We were projecting, I think it was 1.16 in the May forecast. That binds the closed session budget. But then you get to September, the actual kicker was 1.07. So that $93 million basically becomes unanticipated net revenue in the current biennium. So the kicker itself seems to sort of propagate itself. one begets the next one. But you can see still $240 million, that's a fairly small threshold, you know, when you're talking in the context of a total of $12 billion. But it currently no kicker projected, and obviously for the... Where are you? Hang on. I'm going the wrong way. There we go. And obviously if we're only up $100,000 relative to the close of session estimate for corporate, we're well below the 18.4 million window that we have to avoid a kicker. The risks here, basically the ones we always talk about. You've heard the economic scenario, a lot of assumptions built into there, and to the degree that the economy were actually to depart from that, particularly with respect to the things that really drive revenues in Oregon, basically corporate profits, asset markets in terms of capital gains, and then personal income, we would see sort of departures then from our revenue forecast. Coming up right now, one of the reasons why this is sort of a light, you know, revenue update light is that in the next few months we will get sort of additional tax years worth of information to plug into the model. So corporate will be 2005, personal income tax will be 2006, and that's where you start to get some real revisions, see how your assumptions merit and go from there. But even then, I would say things are tracking right now, so probably little expectation of that. I think the big risk right now is what we've been talking about here, that here on November 20th, we've sort of had been reading the tea leaves in terms of what we're seeing happen at the Department of Revenue and, you know, refunds and collections. And it's a month from now we could sort of get information that would say, hey, our reading of those tea leaves was right or wrong. That's probably the biggest risk right now is, you know, refunds aren't up because of some processing issue. They're up because refunds are up in tax liabilities now. So I would put a low probability on that, but that's still one of the risks that's out there. If we look at prior biennium on average for this December forecast relative to ultimate revenues, we'd place a fairly confident confidence interval around about $525 million either way. With, of course, then the tails being lower probability but still potentially possible, say, if we were to suffer all of a sudden a severe recession tomorrow.
Let me ask you about that item. My recollection from the last report you had was that you considered the downside risk higher than the upside risk. Has that changed as you describe this confidence interval, or do you still have that same belief but understand the possible upside to be an equivalent number but less likely? Give us a sense about that.
Yes, Chair Barnhart, that is still likely the case given where we stand today. I mean, if you look where we've come from in the last 3 years and how strong that growth is up to the plateau we're at now, you would still say, obviously, we aren't talking huge upside risks now in the economic forecast, but we are continuing to talk more and more about those downsides. So you would probably put higher probability, say, on that next tail. You know, the next, say, standard deviation is sort of down to, say, 1,000,050 or 1,050,000,000. That probably second standard deviation probably has a much higher probability on it than the second standard deviation would be on the upside. It's very little likelihood we're going to get, you know, another year from now and be talking about $1 billion more into this thing than we have now. What is the actual probability? You'd say to be $1 billion down from now, given that we're tracking, that's got to be a low probability, but reasonable, you know, if you just start to chalk up all the things going wrong. Housing market keeps tanking, everything goes wrong, and then the global economy sort of slides. You could see it happening. But you still have to sort of build a pretty bleak case to get to $1 billion down.
So just to reiterate, your projection at this point is a steady state, more or less.
Given that thing, Mr. Chair, given the things...
The most likely outcomes, let's put it that way.
Thanks. Sure, yes, it is, right. Is what you would consider the baseline case, given a baseline economic scenario.
Thank you.
And sort of to extend on to that, if you look at where Oregon sits right now in terms of what we depend upon for our personal income taxes in particular, we are not in a... We do not look like we looked in 2001. Where we were so heavily concentrated in high tech, and we had a lot of people in this state who had paid a lot of taxes on, say, high tech stocks. We're not there now. You know, if you take the risks out there facing the national economy and then you look at just your average Oregonian, you'd say, you know, the downside risks are very mild compared to that. So,
if I could translate, it sounds like you're saying the risks for the United States as a whole are larger than the risks for Oregon as you perceive things now.
Mr. Chair, I would say so. I'd say Oregon is flip side now, insulated from, in particular, the housing market because we didn't ride the boom up as much as other markets. Maybe not the U.S. as a whole, but you could certainly identify a number of markets where you'd say those guys look like Oregon looked 5 years ago.
Thank you. That stimulated other questions? Thanks. Go ahead.
Thanks. Going forward in the future biennium, we have mild revisions upward, and most of that's all personal income tax. We had a fairly substantial correction in corporate income tax just given how fast it had grown, and just the feeling by our advisors and sort of the national forecast providers is that, you know, we're probably going to sail through with corporate income tax, in particular because apportionment is going to take much of the volatility out of it. So we actually took a little bit of that sort of down out, left sort of the outer years growth in corporate income tax or profits in there. So you've got some personal income tax, some corporate income tax revision, and inheritance tax, just given the current revision, we basically level shifted it up. It's about $80 million in the next biennium, additional revenues, and $123 million in 11-13. And then in terms of growth, our current biennium, if you take out the kicker, just looking at the blue bars, following a record 23.6% growth, we're at about 10%, and then projecting outer year growth, sort of trend growth of about 12% growth. Now for a little more fun. Moving on to the lottery revenue forecast, I kind of wanted to back up and reflect back over the last year and a half. This chart shows year-over-year change in video lottery sales. We use a four-week moving average just to keep the thing from bouncing all over the place. But if you'll remember a year and a half ago, we were at 35% year-over-year growth in video sales, and that was because of line games. That was sort of pretty much a year-over-year change from the addition of line games. And then our scenario was, what did we expect? Well, we would expect that to come down in some fashion to what we considered long-term growth of about 5 to 6%, which is basically in line with consumption growth. And then as we continue to produce forecasts, we got thrown off by these what you would call false drops. You know, you can see them in here, and these actually coincide almost identically with the release of forecasts. They do. But as you can see, eventually it did obey and slide. I put in.
He needs to elaborate on that.
Yes. You have more effect on the gaming than you thought.
It's a delusional issue, but. And so you can see, though, that it has, in fact, sort of not smoothly, but dropped down along these lines. And we now, we're here. This is the new forecast, and we now project that we'll sort of stay right in that sort of 5 to 6% growth going forward, trend growth. However, this is then the week-to-week difference between the September forecast and actual sales. And as you can see, throughout the summer and into September, we were doing quite nicely, and then midway through October, we saw a significant departure between actual sales and the September forecast. And so this was a big discussion point, obviously, at our lottery revenue forecast review meeting. And basically two different explanations came up. One is, as you may remember, these weeks were actually unseasonably nice. I mean, it was it's very, very good October, very good early November, bright out. The variable we use for seasonality in our model is temperature. And the problem is it does really well during the summer, but when you have a crisp 20-degree day that's bright out in November, the model predicts that sales should be really high because people should be inside, but in fact, you know, at the margin, they're not. So what happens is you may well be seeing these solely because at the margin people said, hey, it's really nice out, let's go to the beach, let's go to the casino, whatever. The other issue, however, is, as we've heard, the consumer is relenting, and relenting for a number of reasons. Particularly at the middle to low income brackets, you're not seeing a whole lot of job growth, and then that discretionary income is being impacted by increasing gas prices, increasing inflation. So one of the issues we may be seeing here is the front end of sort of the impact of that issue. When all was said and done, we basically decided on both and sort of split the difference. Some of this is probably an indication of that, indication of gas prices, et cetera, but some of that is likely due to that at-the-margin behavioral issue. So what's the impact? Before we get to the impact, I have to basically overview one last thing. Lottery, Oregon State Lottery, sort of in looking at their current year business plan, basically came to the conclusion that they would be generating some amount of administrative savings in this business year, this current fiscal year. That is, they'd get to the end of the year, and when they subtracted out retailer commissions and their administrative expenses and the four quarterly transfers they would have already made under our forecast, there would be additional monies, and they would transfer that in October. So what they decided was we basically increased the transfer rate for the three quarters, the current one plus the next two, such that $18.5 million is added to the forecast, just within the earnings forecast. So basically accelerating the delivery of that from October as administrative savings to structurally as an earnings transfer for three quarters. So that decision adds 18.5. So then what you can see is there's actually a negative earnings change from the video sales forecast that we've factored in, and that's 8.1 down, and then there's another $2 million in the traditional side. The net total of all this is that we have 12.9 additional in lottery earnings. But in remembering that under that, structurally speaking, there is a decrease in the video sales forecast going forward. So when you get to the bottom line and take out the dedications, it's a $9 million increase in the ending balance to $36.6 million, which I know is of interest.
Mr. Chair, that really is just a timing difference is what it really is then. Thank you.
Yeah, we're getting ahead, Bob. Yes, thank you.
Going forward, then you can see the impact. You can see the increase here in the earnings for the current biennium, but then you see decreases going forward of about, I think it was about $18 million and $19.9 million decreases because of just slightly lower video sales projections going forward.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Does that include line games? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick.
Oh, I'm not much of a gambler, Mr. Chair.
And our standard chart just showing where do all the dollars go and going forward what the discretionary funds look like.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
I'm just a little perplexed at the last slide right there. Michael, short of temperature-adjusted gaming activities, weather-related gaming activities, I don't see that the fuel prices and the other kinds of things that would encourage people to game from 07, 09, and 9/11 would be jumping up by 2011, 2013. That rather significant increase there represents certainly about a 10% increase. Are you anticipating new line games? And certainly there wouldn't be the one-time temporary transfer adjustment either. So help me reconcile with the 10% increase out in the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the problem is not here. The problem is here. What you have in here is roughly $70 to $80 million in administrative savings that has not been projected going forward.
But then, if I may,
if we were to take that out of here, then what you would have is basically gains going forward that would be along this line. That's kind of where you need to, because we've already been realizing the line gains here, right? They came into being in May of 2005. All right, and so you already have line games factored in here. If you were to put a line through here, you would have where you would be here and pretty much what our forecast would have been, say, 2 years ago. You're up to here because of a $56 million that was transferred as administrative savings this October, plus now we factored in $18.5 million more that was not in the original forecast but is now in the forecast that they would have transferred in October of 2008.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
My concern is that that what you have is you have a, with the addition of the line games in 2005, you have a steady growth of the increase in lottery consumption. My concern has been that in the past, without the addition of new venues, you had a rather short line of gain and then a somewhat stagnation. So if you go back in that history, if you watch the lines move up, you can connect each one of those forecasted increases or actual increases was connected to a change in venues. My concern is that without there's enough negative factors now implied in the future, and without the addition of new venues, And I think Oregon is second only to Florida at this particular point in terms of gambling venues that we have available in our economy today, legally. Then at that particular point, where does this additional money come from? It must be from a more robust economy? I don't see that.
Chair Representative Butler, if you go actually back to this right here, and these are year-over-year growth rates, but what you can do is tie every one of these bump-ups to capital investments on the part of lottery in terms of new types of games, the gaming itself and the terminals themselves. From what our forecast has been based on is sort of the inference or sort of the stance of lottery that it will continue as a business to make the investments it needs to do to maintain market share and deliver those, basically deliver those earnings. So I think that's, I think that answers the question, at least from a forecast perspective, is those are the assumptions that underlie the continued growth going forward. As well as the fact that people seem to have no limit to the amount of money they're willing to pump into them, sort of a from a consumer behavioral standpoint.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with the very last comment. Certainly, as there was a rather significant downturn in the economy in 2001-03, we saw a greater consumption of the lottery venues. And so if that's what this portends, that's probably fine. My concern is that that with the you're factoring in the folks' ability to continue to borrow against revenues, consumer consumption, borrowing against inflation and those kinds of things. My concern is that there are enough negative factors that kind of a future forecast, a 10% increasing when we're dropping down to the 5 and 6, and actually your forecast was closer to 4 as I figured it out there, I wouldn't have seen that kind of, I wouldn't have estimated that kind of increase unless you've got the strange effects of a recession on gambling. And of course then that affects other revenues too, because we saw that tobacco revenues increased, we saw liquor revenues increase, and then we saw the death tax increase too. So you can drink and smoke and gamble and still die with money in Oregon. Great place to live.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Mr. Kennedy, there were two pieces of legislative action that occurred that we were told would negatively affect lottery. One was the expansion of the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act to prohibit smoking in bars and taverns, which will take effect January of 2009, I believe. And the other was clamping down on payday loans. We were told that at least 10% of these payday loans were used by addicted gamblers to get their money ahead of time so they could go and play the games. Both of those actions would seem to have a negative impact on overall lottery revenue. Have you considered that in your forecast out beyond 2009?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, let's take one at a time. You were no doubt in with the discussions about the smoking ban and the impact, and I think you heard the variety of interpretations that could be made of the existing data, and sort of that ultimately led us to say, hold the line, we're not going to build in an impact because it's really, really subject, to error. You could see them go up, you could see them go down. I think in particular my issue with the localities was the substitutability of banning smoking in, say, a city and then saying, okay, you had this huge drop, because there is a serious problem there with just substitution, say, driving from Corvallis to Albany. I mean, if you're one of the people who's pumping in $1,000 a month into line games, I think you'll be motivated enough to go find a place where you can also... that's my natural belief, again, as Representative Butler said, in human nature. So we did not do that. If there's an impact, our thoughts was it was going to be fairly minimal. It was not going to be 10% decline in sales. If it's 1%, okay, then so be it. And we basically have built in an ending balance here that's going to be able to
allow for minor departures in that case.
Mr. Chair, follow up, please.
Well, you know, when we were discussing the expansion of the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act, the representatives of the tobacco industry absolutely guaranteed us that it would cost us lottery money. Are you telling me that they sometimes lie?
Exaggerate, perhaps. You don't have to answer that question.
No intention.
And with respect to the payday,
some questions are rhetorical. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Senator Monroe, with respect to the second, the payday loans, just as an economist thinking, unless somehow payday loans allow people to spend money they don't have, all you're talking about is a temporal shift. If I just sit there and think, there's a body of income that's out there, discretionary income, that some fraction of that's going to be spent on these machines. I don't see that payday loans really affect one thing or another, except if you ban them, you might have a two-week shift back in where some people might spend their money, and then onward we go with life as usual. Unless it allows them to default over and over, but I can't see you can file Chapter 11 on a weekly basis. So I just don't see that that one was going to have as big an impact. I can see the smoking ban, but again, the substitutability. If every state around us has banned smoking and you're sitting there and you're ultimately deciding which addiction you want to feed, I have faith that they'll figure out a way to feed both of them.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, harkening back to prior forecasts, we were talking about going from $80 a barrel gasoline or fuel down to $60 a barrel, and these were the times that we had projected $60 a barrel when we're actually approaching $100 a barrel. Earlier forecasts, we had not heard the word subprime used for many sessions. The continued weakening of the U.S. dollar abroad, in spite of all of these things, and I'd like to have your response, particularly with regard to the price per barrel of fuel, of fuel oil. You're still projecting that we are on track, because previously, the projection was that fuel would actually drop down to 60 per barrel.
Representative Butler, excuse me, and chairs. We assume that the oil price will stabilize. Yes, we know that the higher oil prices will negatively impact the U.S. economy and Oregon's economy. But what we saw in the past several quarters is that despite high oil prices, its impact on the rest of the economy has been rather limited. And what that means is the global economy and the U.S. economy withstood this higher oil prices very well until now. Now, we're reaching $100 per barrel. We subscribe to the opinion that the U.S. economy is much less sensitive to energy price at this point because of economic activities relying much less than energy in general in terms of total spending. So that will actually help us to get through these high oil prices. And what the consensus is at this point among economists, and we have to admit that economists are really horrible in forecasting. but what happens is the consensus among economists these days is $100 oil will not crack the economy, will further slow down the economy, but it will not lead us into recession. And in fact, our forecast has been that we're going to see almost no growth in the second half of this year, and we're going to see a very weak the first couple of months in 2008. So implicitly, we're assuming some negative effect coming from energy prices. So yes, we'll continue to watch the development in oil prices, but at this point, its overall impact on the economy is rather limited.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And fortunately, Oregon's economy is not, at this time, as heavily reliant upon natural resources, because I can assure you that in the natural resource sector, $100 a barrel oil doesn't float. It's very difficult for us to be paying $4 for a gallon of diesel to move those farm products or to cultivate, harvest, plant new crops. And my concern is that while that may work in the largely industrialized sector along the I-5 corridor, it does not work in the balance of Oregon and could also damage some of our shipping and seaports along the state of Oregon as well, as that diesel has to be, that more expensive diesel has to be used in the fishing activities as well. So farming, fishing, and timber and natural resources are certainly affected by this. But as I say, fortunately, I think that's probably a very, very small percentage of what goes on in Oregon. Most folks believe that, you just go to Safeway or Albertsons to buy that's where milk and bread comes from.
So the rest of Oregon may be less affected, but District 60 is highly affected.
And as is Representative Witt's district, with the high price of fuel to get the boats out and back.
Thank you. Other microeconomic comments or questions?
Sorry, boss.
It occurs to me, just as I think this is really a statement rather than a question, but you may want to respond to it, that when we talk about oil, we talk about changes in the global situation, we talk about long-term fundamental changes in the world's economy. We look at things like the increased use of oil and coal in India and in China for industrialization. The idea that oil will continue to go increase in price or cost over time doesn't surprise me very much. It seems likely, in fact. And to the extent that transportation costs are a big part of a product's cost, those products will be increasingly less competitive in a market where other goods have lower transportation costs. I assume those things to be true. And therefore, the parts of our economy that are based on shipping things long distances, like selling wheat in Asia or wherever it is we sell it, may be at a relative disadvantage, whereas a local farmer who sells locally may be at a relative advantage for the same reason. Do you have any comments about that kind of an analysis? Is that a valid way of looking at the long term or not? Or what do you think? Recognizing, of course, that there will be fluctuations in the meantime.
Sure, Bonhart. Again, we admit that our economists don't do a good job of forecasting the future. Having said that, if you look at fundamentals in producing oil, there is a consensus that the current high level cannot continue. A lot of it, in fact, if you look at the futures contract side, is a consequence of speculators coming in. So what you have in oil prices at this point is a huge premium for so-called risk engineered by Wall Street speculators. Not all of the prices, but huge portion of it in the past 3-4 months. So if you look at how much it costs to extract and refine and transport and sell, The outlook for oil price is not that pessimistic, in fact. And as oil prices stabilize, we're going to gain back whatever loss of competitive advantage in transportation. And that's a long-term view, actually. It may not happen right away, but I happen to believe that if there is price incentive, then supply will come. And that's what's happening these days. Although people are predicting that there will be oil shortage, there is so much that we can extract. We will find more oil fields. We will find substitutes, alternative energies, which means we shouldn't be too pessimistic about energy prices in general.
Thank you.
Chair
Burdick,
if you can estimate, what would you estimate with $100 a barrel oil would be the speculator premium? What part of that would you estimate would be?
Chair Burdick, I happen to believe that without the speculation, it would be about around $70 per barrel. But then I wouldn't be surprised if the price comes down even further. We've seen this huge volatility in oil prices in the past. Huge run-up in the past 3-4 months is an aberration, in my opinion. But then if it's only if that we get into real conflict with Iran, then all bets are off.
Yeah. Thank you. That's
helpful.
You're introducing the geopolitical issue. There's another geopolitical issue that you haven't addressed yet, and that's the one having to do with climate change and the political and economic response to those issues. I haven't heard anything about that in your analysis. Do you have any thoughts about that issue, or is that simply too speculative at this point?
Mr. Chair, as a person, I really worried about global warming, but at the same time, I haven't studied the impact of global warming on energy issues, so I don't have the answer.
It has a beachfront in Eastern Oregon.
Well, one of the possible approaches, of course, is that there becomes a strong political interest in global warming issues. We start doing a much better job of increasing alternative energy sources, increasing efficiency, reducing the use of coal-fired plants, maybe even reducing the use of oil for transportation. In those cases, of course, the price of oil would decline considerably because of the reduction in demand. The other alternative, of course, is the alternative you've already given, or the explanation, or the analysis you've already given, in which those kinds of things don't happen, and then the effects you're describing actually take place until or unless the effects on the economy of climate change become a problem, if they do. Appreciate that. Are there further questions? I think we're scheduled now for a recess until 10:30. Thank you very much for your analysis and your presentation. As always, it was an interesting presentation. We are very pleased that the actual information presented was quite dull. With that, we are in recess until 10:30.
After our break, we'll reconvene the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee and start that piece of it. We have a quorum here.
And the House Committee on Revenue will reconvene.
Okay. We will start out. Our next agenda item is to talk about items on the agenda for February. The House and Senate have different processes, so I'll let my co-chair here talk about the House process. But in the Senate, our process is that there are 20 bills that are being divided among the committees, and the Revenue Committee, Finance and Revenue Committee, has been allocated three bills that Mr. Warner will describe for us in a minute. And in addition, each member of the Senate will have one bill that they can introduce as a member. And as chair of the committee, I will be introducing a revenue-related bill, which will also come before this committee. So with that, we now have Paul Warner to tell us about the three bill drafts that we'll be considering.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The chair met with Senate President and went through the list, and I have should have a copy of that for you. List three bill draft requests, and I believe we've talked about each of these at the previous meeting, but these have now been formally requested of council. And the first one is an issue involving credit for use of TRICARE medical insurance, a physician's credit to try to increase the availability of TRICARE insurance. We've had some issues around interpretation of that credit, how it's to be calculated, specifically an issue whether it's cumulative over a number of years in terms of participants or whether it's fixed at some level. What we wanted to do is clarify your intent with the Office of Rural Health Policy as to what your policy is. Madam Chair, I understand there are folks here from Office of Rural Health Policy.
Maybe we could bring them up just to go over what the problem is here that needs fixing.
Good morning, Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Scott Eckblatt. I'm the director of the Office of Rural Health, the Oregon Office of Rural Health. We have had a little bit of difficulty interpreting some of the language in the bill, and I'll start out by explaining what we think we understand about the bill and check with you to see if that matches the intent. First of all, it appears that the bill puts a cap of people who can participate in this tax credit at $500 per year. So beginning with the first year, it would be $500. Then with the second, and it begins with tax year 2008. So in 2008, it would be $500. In 2009, we interpret it to mean that the same $500 would remain eligible for the tax credit, but then another $500 could be added in 2009. An additional $500 in 2010, an additional $500 in 2011. And so in consultation with Mr. Allenack, that's how we have decided to interpret the bill. But if there's something different, we'd certainly like to know.
And that is a crucial question. Paul, did we have this cumulative impact in the revenue impact when we first took up this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, we did. Chris made that assumption when he was doing the revenue impact as part of House Bill 3201.
Okay. Right. And that's actually what the bill does. It just clarifies that point. Right. Okay. All right.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Monroe.
So what you're saying is your bill, or the committee bill, in fact, clarifies existing practice and interpretation?
Senator Monroe, I wouldn't say existing practice because we haven't implemented this yet.
Okay.
So we're implementing in 2008. So the office is in the process of preparing to implement it. So this issue came up in discussions when they were planning to implement it, and this is where we saw the need to clarify exactly what your intent was before we get the program actually started.
And I can't remember the original bill well enough. Did we have any kind of sunset on this bill?
You want to come up, Chris?
Chris.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there was a sunset. I believe it was, I can't recall exactly when it was. It was in 2011, 2012. It was somewhere 4 to 6 year.
And for
sunset.
The record, your name is?
I'm sorry, Chris Allenack with the Legislative Revenue Office.
We lose our memory here after during interim. Thank you. Thanks for clarifying that, Chris, and thanks for your work on this.
So, Madam Chair, if I could just add one thing. You recall the policy decision is to see if this incentive is going to be effective in terms of getting more participation. And that was really the issue that it was the military department that talked to us about that, saying that they would like to see further availability for veterans of the health insurance package. So this would be a way to try to encourage use of it. And then we can come back and see how effective it's been.
Yeah, along those lines, aren't there other barriers involved that keep people? I mean, I've heard that the system is very bureaucratic, that might be a barrier. What are your comments on that?
I have heard anecdotal information from healthcare providers that are not currently contracting, that their reasons are that it's highly bureaucratic. I think the primary reason is probably that the reimbursement for those services is so low.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions?
I do have one larger challenge I'd like to bring up, actually. The largest challenge in implementing this program is the maximum of 500 that can qualify. And the problem boils down to how do we determine which 500 will receive the credit? Because, for example, the current number of non-contracted providers that could be eligible for the program is 39,250. The currently non-contracted rural who could be eligible is 10,398. So we need some sort of process to determine just those that are currently contracted and providing TRICARE services. There are 1,200 in rural and roughly 1,000 in urban. So what we have done is we've brought together a group of stakeholders, people from TriWest, the people who administer the program, Regents, their subcontractor, members of our staff, and what the idea that we're batting around is to change the numbers that are currently in statute. The statute or the bill reads that any provider in an urban community who sees 10 or more patients would be eligible for the credit. If you're in a rural community, you can see less than 10. So theoretically down to 1. If we we could arrive at roughly 500 almost exactly if we were to say that if you're in a frontier community, you have to see 1 or more. If you're in a rural community, you have to see 15 or more. And if you're in an urban community, you have to see
40. That's a little more detail than we can do at the bill introduction stage, but thank you for making us familiar with the issue.
Sure.
It should be a very interesting hearing.
It will.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Chris. All right. Next bill.
Thanks, Chris. Madam Chair, the second bill is one that we've requested to be drafted. Really, it's kind of the normally biennial. You'll have a connection to the federal tax code. In this case, since you are meeting in February, it would make sense, I think, to look and see what changes were made in 2007 by Congress, and then give you an opportunity to either connect or not connect to those. Under our rolling reconnect law, you do automatically connect to tax base changes. Now, there may be things that you don't want to automatically connect to. The February session gives you an opportunity to do that. There are also changes that are not directly affect the base, and therefore you don't automatically connect to, that you may want to. The tricky part of this is we have a hard time predicting the economy, but an even harder time predicting what Congress is going to do. So, and they have not enacted their major tax bill this session. We know that they will because they have a fundamental issue around the alternative minimum tax. And they're likely, the betting is they're going to have to deal with that in some way, and it'll probably be part of the package. And so this, what we're doing is asking the council draft a placeholder for you so you'll be able to react to that federal law and give you an opportunity to make some policy decisions around that.
Okay. Any questions on this one? Okay, third one.
The third one is based on some discussions, particularly between the chair and vice chair at our last Senate Finance and Revenue meeting, and that is it grows out of a discussion that was started last session in the Ways and Means Committee over the tax gap and the amount of potential personal and corporate income tax revenue there is under current law relative to the actual amount being collected. And that's kind of this definition of a tax gap. We don't have a specific recommendation at this point, but the idea behind the draft would be for the Department of Revenue to examine the reasons for that gap, to get better understanding of the behavior that's causing that gap, and come to you in 2009 with some very specific recommendations to do that. There is some potential if you want the Department of Revenue to focus some resources on, in effect, studying this and analyzing it, there may be some fiscal impact to it.
Thank you. Do you have any questions on this? All right. I will now turn it over to my honorable co-chair, and we can talk about the House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the importance of this meeting today for the House and ultimately, of course, for the Senate, if we pass bills, is that the House process is a little different from the Senate process. In the House, the plan for the February session is that individual members will not be introducing bills, but instead all bills will be coming through committees. Each committee has the option of suggesting the introduction of a policy bill that related to the parameters within which we're planning to operate for the February session. We have also the opportunity of asking the Rules Committee to allow us to draft additional bills based on the need or the potential need. Now, of course, in the revenue area, as is true in the Ways and Means area, some of these possibilities are yet unclear. I expect that the House Revenue Committee will meet at least a couple of times in January for the purpose of finalizing drafts so that when the February session starts, we can introduce bills immediately. Because they'll already be drafted, get them back immediately so we can act on them in the first week. If we don't do that, if we don't have that kind of a schedule, the chances of actually completing work in the month of February, decline significantly. So we, in effect, are going to try to pre-plan this, which is hence the reason for the suggestion of a work session today. I have talked with both of the vice chairs about the various possibilities for things that we could talk about, and I'd like to just list those and then ask members of the committee if they have other suggestions of things that we either ought to introduce ourselves or ask the Rules Committee to introduce. And those are no particular order, just a listing of the ones that we've talked about. A potential reconnect bill to deal with issues that have already been raised in the Senate bill, but which, because of constitutional reasons, have to come from the House. And that would essentially be a placeholder relating to revenue bill, because at this point we don't know what Congress is going to do, and it's possible that a reconnect bill would be a three-fifths bill and would therefore require being introduced in the House, because revenue bills have to start in the House. A second one would be a bill involving a small change in the business energy tax credit bill that we passed last time to deal with the reality that our Betsy bill was intended originally to deal with the retail end user of renewable energy production devices like solar panels and that kind of thing. Businesses may buy those things and then use the electricity themselves. What we're learning is that, and of course, as you all know, businesses are coming into Oregon to manufacture these devices, which of course raises a whole different set of considerations. The Betsy is apparently not as well tuned to the issue of manufacturing these devices as it is to encouraging the use by the ultimate consumer of them. And it may be that we'll need a small clarification in that law in order to deal with that. That, of course, will have, may have fiscal implications, probably not in this biennium, but in future biennium. So we need to talk about those as well. So that's a second item. I have discussed that with the governor's office and also with the Department of Energy, and they agree that it it's prudent at this point to ask for a bill in that area, with the understanding that by the middle of January we'll know whether we actually have to do this or not. The third area that we've talked about is the need for a clarification of the Natural Resources Property Inheritance Tax bill that we passed last time, which apparently, according to the bar, has a number of issues that they've raised, and you've got a six-page report from the ad hoc work group dated October 15th of issues that have come up with that in that bill. This is going to be a fairly complex issue, one that the that I think we need to address, and that they tell us we need to address in order to avoid litigation issues during 2008. And of course, while it's still relatively fresh in our own minds as to what we were dealing with, that's one we may want to consider as well. And then the last possibility is one that actually came up in the media in the last few days, having to do with the way in which a portion of the Education Stability Fund is used to provide funds for the Oregon Growth Account, and the fact that those two funds have essentially different goals. And the way I try to characterize that issue, it is not the issue of whether we ought to have an Oregon Growth Account, or even that it ought to be administered the way it is being administered, but whether it ought to be a part of the fund that we may need to have available at any time in connection with an emergency. You don't put your emergency in the long-term investments. You take your long-term investment account out of other long-term investments when that's possible. I'm not suggesting that we write a bill that does major changes to the Oregon Growth Account, but I am suggesting that the legislature may want to consider limiting the input of new funds into that account during 08, with the idea in mind that the 09 session would consider what to do about it. A couple of alternatives that we've discussed already in small conversations is that that account might be more appropriately connected with some other long-term accounts that we have in the state, such as the public employee retirement system accounts, which are not available for emergency funding, and which we understand have contains large numbers of dollars that are in long-term assets and so forth. But anyway, that's not a decision to be made in 08. The decision to be made in 08 is whether or not we want to ask the treasurer to hold off on new investment commitments during 08 so that legislature in 09 can make decisions about the account. Those are the suggestions that we've already discussed. I'd like to talk about those in a committee work session, but I'd like to also talk about other suggestions that either members of the House committee, or since the senators here, members of the Senate committee might have for things that we ought to consider. As you can see, just the list I've given gives us a pretty full plate to get done with in a small and a very short session discussion. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Recently, I became aware that there's probably an area, and I'm going to guess that the Senate's discussion list may capture the essence of one of the things that has been brought up in the tax gap, and that would be with regard to the importation of other tobacco products, gray market, and those kinds of things, and probably eventually the refunding of the enforcement of the tobacco tax in the state of Oregon. And so rather than propose a bill, certainly with the Department of Revenue, and as indicated by Dr. Warner, there's probably some fiscal implications relative to funding a tax gap study, But whatever is done there, we need to certainly take a look at the importation of other tobacco products and NPM products and those kinds of things, as opposed to continuing on. And that's an area of less controversy than to try and get our arms around it in a special session. The other items that I had, Senator Deckert had talked to me briefly about the extension of additional kinds of pollution control tax credits. I think that certainly the allowance to allow pollution control tax credits to go away for standard kinds of investments is one thing, and I think that certainly is something that could be considered over into the regular session 09, because I think most of the ongoing credits will continue on through 08, and certainly those folks who have invested will continue to see the benefits of those. So that continues to be an item of concern because we did not renew the standard pollution control tax credits in the last session. Final issue that I had was relative to compliance, and that's with regard to the 4% withholding tax. The 4% real estate withholding tax, I'm going to guess that by now, Mr. Chair, you've had an opportunity to discuss with the Department of Revenue where they're at in the rules-making process, but my understanding that from the time that they came forward and said, yeah, no problem, and certainly well within our budget to do the kinds of things that you're doing, and recognizing that some of the simpler states had 30 and 40 page brochures on how to get those things done, we're still not any further close to collecting a 4% transfer tax on real estate for out-of-state sales or out-of-state sellers in the state of Oregon. Then, I shouldn't say we're not any closer, but we do not have the regulations promulgated at this time. So my hope is that we could have a robust conversation around that compliance issue that raised its head during the regular session in 2007.
Thank you. Others?
Mr. Chair, just
Senator Westland.
General comment. I want to go back to your Oregon growth account issue that you raised, and while I don't want to go into the depth of the discussion here, I'd just like to say I think it's a more involved discussion than has been recently perceived, if you will. So I want to tread prudently on that issue. So,
thank you, Senator. I completely agree. I think it requires a very careful conversation, and my suggestion is basically to give the legislature maximum flexibility in dealing with it rather than to do something precipitous. And I appreciate that your comment very much. Other thoughts? And your comments about the suggestions that have already been made or other suggestions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator. Just, Representative Butler.
Just to follow up from Senator Westland's comments, the venture capital, recognize, please, that the venture capital industry in Oregon is a baby. It is brand new. We have only had venture capital businesses in Oregon actually set up with storefronts in Oregon for just a few years. Mm-hmm. And of course, what encouraged those folks to come to town was the fact that we were going to have some public funds that could be available. So I think that Senator Westland's precaution is very excellent, that we tread very carefully in that process, because you could be stepping on a fledgling industry who've come to town with some real tremendous investments and really some great aspirations for new business and particularly along the clusters that we've got in Oregon growing up now. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, unless there's some other comment, I'd like to open a work session for the House Revenue Committee for the purpose of motions to make proposals about bills. So that will open the work session. And let me simply comment that it seems to me that the bill of the greatest urgency of the ones that we're looking at probably is the Natural Resources Property Inheritance Tax issue, because it's probably not a huge issue in the sense of the number of people it's going to affect this next year, but getting it right now will affect planning that is going on for people as they plan their estates. As you know, One of the reasons why we have a volunteer lawyers work group that has prepared this long set of comments is because the lawyers find themselves in a situation where they're giving advice to clients to establish their estate plans in a situation in which they consider the statute to be deficient. What that means is that you have the possibility of litigation after the death of the person that you prepared the estate plan for, only to discover that that your bulletproof document was in fact overturned by a court, and it didn't mean what you thought it meant. So in that sense, there's some urgency on that issue. My suggestion is that on the other issues we've raised, we have an additional week to explore the issues before we actually ask the Rules Committee for introduction of those bills. And what I would like is authority to ask the Rules Committee for those bills here. So what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I would move that that the House Interim Revenue Committee advance as its priority piece of legislation for the 2008 special session that bill, the corrections to that bill, which is known as the 7.5 property bill dealing with natural resource inheritance tax exclusion for farmland, forest land, and commercial fishing operations. That would be the first part of a motion that I would make.
Why don't we do that? Deal with that one first.
Thank you.
Can we have discussion on that topic first? Is there any objection to that motion? All right. Seeing no objection to that motion carries. Representative Butler, you had another motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would then also move that because we are now at the limit of the Revenue Committee for the bills which we can introduce under the proposed House rules for the 2008 special session, that the Chair author a letter to the Speaker relative to the possibility of introducing other legislation commensurate with the discussion which we've had today dealing with the Recon Act and the venture capital, other kinds of compliance issues, those kinds of things, so that we can have those on the table. I would hate to have a Recon Act bill started in the Senate which we could not act on, for it had the effect of raising taxes and therefore would be outside of the scope of what we could actually accomplish in a special session. So my motion would be that the Chair proceed with Dr. Warner and Revenue staff to prepare the letters to proceed to ask the Speaker to proceed with, to allow us that latitude through the Rules Committee.
Thank you. And does that motion also include the manufacturing equipment plants in the battery?
Yes, I'm sorry. That's the business energy tax credit for the manufacturing of the energy, that
great
alternative energy.
So this contemplates several additional bills that would be introduced by the Rules Committee.
It does, along the lines of your discussion here today, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Further discussion of that motion? Is there any objection to that motion? All right. Hearing none, that motion is adopted. I'll simply inform the committee that that motion contemplates several different letters, and what I'm planning to do is to send one letter on each topic to the Rules Committee. We'll certainly inform the Speaker of the thoughts. I want to be very cautious about how much work we give ourselves for January and early February. At the same time, I don't want to be caught on January 15th without a vehicle for something that's come up in the meantime. Are there other issues that the committee thinks that we ought to ask the Rules Committee to allow us to address? We have thought about this with some care, but that doesn't mean we haven't missed something. All right. Well, with that, we'll close the work session now, but we'll also reserve the right, because we have additional presentations today, we'll reserve the possibility of reopening that work session for additional motions. And with that, we'll close the work session. Paul, where are we on the agenda?
Mr. Chair, the issue that we have been spending some time working on, as you mentioned, is a very complicated one, and that is the natural resource estate tax treatment that you enacted in 3201, and you've made reference to the work ad hoc work group for the bar and the CPAs, and we do have Jeff Shane here from the that has worked on that ad hoc group. He addressed the Senate, but Jeff is willing to go through that with us again. We also have Deborah Buchanan here to talk about kind of where the department has been in terms of their work on the estate tax.
We got through our discussion so expeditiously that we have 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. Why don't we ask them to give us the thumbnail on that, so that we'll have, this gives us a heads up before we get to our January meetings on the bill.
Right, because as remind the committee that we will be making a formal draft request based on this meeting today to council. So the more direction you can give us, the better we are.
Thank
in
you.
Terms
that,
of
that's an excellent
talking with
suggestion.
Council, and council is here in the audience too.
Great.
The draftor.
That's also a good idea. Would you come forward and to the extent you want to make a presentation on the memo that you've drafted, I think the committee would appreciate that.
Thank you.
And committee, this is in front of you. It's the piece with the boxes.
Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey Sheen. I'm an estate planning attorney. I'm with the law firm of Samuel Jolin Cantor in Portland. Although I haven't been officially nominated as the chair, but we've put together a work group under the auspices of the Oregon State Bar, but also utilizing a group of CPAs as well as estate planning attorneys to review House Bill 3201, specifically Section 68 that was passed. And I've prepared a list of policy issues, and I won't spend time going through each one like I did last time, but I think the big issue that needs to be resolved is whether or not this is an exemption, in other words, to or an exclusion. And if we treat it as an exclusion, it takes $7.5 million of a natural resources estate off of the table, essentially for tax purposes, and tax the remainder at your current rate schedule. If it's treated as an exclusion, then it simply generates a credit, so that up to $7.5 million.
No, you said exclusion both times.
Okay. If it's treated as an exemption, then it creates a tax credit, if you will, of up to $7.5 million, no tax. And once you go over that threshold, then you start to hit a rather steep increase in the tax, and eventually it gets fully recaptured as the value of the estate increases. So I think that's probably the issue that has the most revenue implications that this committee needs to deal with.
If I can interrupt Jeff here for a minute, and I have mentioned this briefly to both Department of Revenue and to Jeff, that one alternative we are looking at is the possibility of a credit that could be introduced, in which you would mimic the effect of the $7.5 million of estate value, and then have that credit phased out as the estate value rises. And we've been working on that, and that gives you a flexibility in terms of the revenue impact. When we calculated the revenue impact, we assumed it was an exemption. In other words, the second of the two descriptions, which gave, as you recall, $1 million impact for the biennium. So if it's an exclusion, it would have a bigger impact than that. The concern we have about the exemption is that it creates the possibility of what we call a cliff effect, that you're going to have people, as Jeff mentioned, you're going to have people that go over $7.5 million, and then they have a very large tax consequence, where if they're below $7.5 million, they're in effect not going to be taxed. So the policy concern we have for, from a tax policy standpoint is you run the risk of creating distorting behavior. People are going to try to avoid that cliff. So that would be one option we're working on for you to see if that might be something that would give you a, you'd have a credit that would correspond to eliminating the tax on $7.5 million worth of value, and then you phase it down so that it gradually phases out so you don't have that cliff involved. And this would allow us to vary the revenue impact by how you set those parameters.
Thank you. Chairman Bernhardt and members of the committee, another area that I'm getting a lot of questions from attorneys and CPAs is whether or not this exemption applies to natural resources property that is held in entities such as corporations, limited liability companies, trusts, and things of that nature. As I understand, I mean, the Department of Revenue has looked at this issue somewhat, and I don't think there's a clear answer. I mean, the code as, or the Section 68 as it was adopted seems to apply only to individuals, at least clearly, but then there's also a reference to interpret it applying Internal Revenue Code Section 2032A, which does allow those kinds of entities to be included. So from our perspective, it would seem, well, we need some clarification so that we can advise our clients on if they want to comply, what they need to do to comply. So those are two sort of definitional issues. And then I think when you look to the definitions that were adopted for the what includes natural resource property, and I think these are fairly easy corrections, so to speak, but there are definitions. For example, the commercial fishing operations was excluded and not wrapped into a definition of natural resource property. So that creates kind of an anomaly that things don't quite fit. Also, there's been some informal opinions issued that the forest land exemption applies only to the land but not the trees, and I don't think that was probably the intention of the authors of this legislation. Similarly, the farmland only applies to farmland but not to the buildings and equipment and other parts of the farming operation.
I may just interrupt and note that we have already asked Representative Boone and Representative Clem, who were among the two sponsors of these issues, to help us craft those definition sections. And we would certainly appreciate the help of your ad hoc group, too, to make certain that we cover those adequately in the bill we're proposing.
Chairman Bernhardt, I think we're prepared, as soon as you've drafted legislation, our committee is prepared to look at it. And our perspective is we don't have a funding axe to grind or policy, but just really trying to focus on, is this something that's clear enough that people can be advised in terms of what how it affects them.
Thank you.
And then I think some of the other stuff that's covered in here is kind of more in the definitional category. I'm not sure that it has revenue impacts, but 2032A of the Internal Revenue Code adopts several standards of that for this kind of policy to qualify. More than the estate has to have more than half of the value in natural resource property. Now, that was not in the legislation that was adopted. Don't know, again, whether it should be, but on the other hand, depending on what the policy is if you're trying to have this apply to taxpayers who are engaged in this type of business, it would seem like that might be a requirement that you want to consider. So I think, you know, that issue, and I think just as a kind of a catch-all is if, for example, the heir to an estate has their property that they have a $7.5 million exemption that they do qualify for, and then the county or the state or whatever comes in and condemns that property, and they reacquire natural resource property. I think that kind of an exemption should continue to apply. Similarly, if they exchange under 1031 and go from farmland to farmland, or that they should still be able to avoid having to deal with the recapture issues if they've continued. And we also suggested that Washington has an exemption statute that covers farmland and forest land, which I gave copies of at the last session, which seems like it might be a decent starting point to draft some of the more technical aspects of this legislation. The things that would have to be dealt with is, I guess the Washington legislation has no cap, so we'd have to bring that in, and they don't apply to commercial fishing operations. But
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Jeff, coming back to the 2032A and the exchange, your specific comment is if they were to lose the farmland, there's a continuity after the death of family members that must be involved in operating the property. Under 2032A, does that also contemplate the fact that there might be a loss of the property and a substitution, therefore there would be the exemption under 2032A would continue uninterrupted?
Correct.
Okay, thank
you. And I think that the Internal Revenue Code Section 2032A, either within the code or in regulation, specifically authorizes the condemnation or the exchange transactions.
And which would be a continuity of the original exemption.
Correct.
Thank you.
So I think there's much more detail here, but you said to keep it brief, so I can close at that point and be available for questions.
Are there burning questions on this issue today? Thank you. I would simply note that we do expect to put a considerable amount of effort into this in the next 2 months, and hope that we can propose to the legislature in February a bill that fixes most, if not all, of these issues. And let me just say for the committee members that it was my understanding as we pursued this idea in the last session that we were concerned about protecting small woodlot, farm, and fishing business owners, those for whom the primary asset of the estate were those businesses that are really unitary businesses that you can't sell a piece of in order to pay the inheritance tax, and that we were not intending to protect large holdings, large businesses, or those with sufficient liquidity so that they can reasonably pay those taxes without harm to the underlying unitary business that we're describing. It's clear that we didn't get there. I mean, in just simply talking about the definitions of these things, that we didn't make it, that we certainly did not intend to cover simply bare land. I think that all of us would agree that we intended to cover the operating business as such. It's also clear that we didn't get there in terms of the way the exemption works. And that it's not clear to me that the legislature actually had a meeting of the minds on what it intended to do with that exemption issue and how much it would be and all that. But I am hoping as one of the fiscal watchdogs and as a part of the fiscal watchdog committee that we figure out a way to get as close to what we intended last year as we can without spending additional tax revenue. So that we get to the place where we do in fact protect in the land use area our farms and our small woodlot owners, and in the fishing area the small fishing businesses, without doing serious violence to state revenues, which essentially means reducing funding for schools and health care. I don't know if other members have comments that they'd like to make about that issue, but I think this is a great time to do it, so we can have those for the drafting of the bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I want to commend you.
Senator Burdick.
Your comments really summarize the way I'm looking at this issue as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, sir.
Thank
we
you.
Very much appreciate your testimony. And you wanted the department to talk about something?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Deborah Buchanan's here, Department of Revenue. She's been working on the, from the DOI standpoint of trying to implement 3201. So
right.
She's available for questions.
May I simply add while she's coming up that we very much appreciate the involvement of the bar's ad hoc committee. The legislature often doesn't have resources of its own to adequately vet all of these issues, and of course the group that you are working with has a keen interest, I know, in us getting these statutes written in a clear way so that you know how to advise your clients, and we appreciate your involvement.
Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue, and I would echo those comments. We have appreciated the assistance as well in attempting to implement the provisions of the bill. I've asked staff to give you just a couple of examples of, I thought numbers might help. The first page in this is the table that's used to calculate the Oregon inheritance tax. And the way we have implemented the provisions of the bill is to consider the $7.5 million an exclusion, an off-the-top subtraction from the gross estate. So you can see here that an estate of $10 million, for example, that had $7.5 million of qualified property would see a reduction in tax of around $830,000. And that would continue to apply for larger estates as well. So, Mr. Chair, in your comments in protecting the smaller estates, you can see that the way we've implemented this doesn't necessarily conform to that. But the opinion we've had from our attorneys is that that's what the plain language of the law provides. So we haven't been able to go back to the testimony in the committees where it seemed to be more clear that you were looking at the small businesses and protecting those. So, again, that's how we have implemented Paul talked about the possibility of establishing a credit. Page 2 gives you just one example of how that could be done. It's merely a concept, and there are other ways that this could be accomplished. But this particular example looks at the value of the natural resource property. The credit then is an approximation of the tax that would be imposed on that value. And as you can see, the credit for a $1 million estate would be around $29,000, $30,000. That credit increases to $7.5 million, where you have a credit of $705,200, which approximates the tax on an estate of that value, and then phases down to where a $15 million estate would have nothing. And, of course, this is a concept. It could be changed in any way you'd like. Another method of establishing credit would be to look at the exact tax that would be imposed on the value of that property and allow that as a credit. So that would be another approach to take. If you want to have recapture of the tax, if they don't have continued use, there's a table at the bottom there of page 2 that shows how that might be done. One question you might ask yourself as far as the policy here is, would you want the recapture of the tax to be paid by the estate or by the individual that receives the property? If the estate has to pay it, the estate either has to remain open or be reopened in order to have that. If it passes on to the heir who receives the property, they could add that to their tax on the individual return. So that might be another way to look at that. Mr. Sheen mentioned the Washington deduction, and I would just point out that with Washington State, it seems to be a different policy that they have in mind. They look at the past activity and say, if the person had been a farmer, or if the even tenant farmers, look at that activity and allow the deduction. There's not the continued use requirement in the future. So there seems to be a different focus than what you had in mind, it appears, with your proposal. So with that, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions if there are some.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Deborah, for a very good presentation. Coming back to your Table B, the table that you're presently using, it would appear that based upon this, that you're not trying, and the department presently is implementing the process of $7.5 million, you're not trying to separate out trees from non-trees on a natural resource property, or are you trying to do that? Because they're not, the value included in the estate is going to be X amount of value for the property.
Chairs, Representative Barnhart, what we have said is look at the whether the property qualifies under the terms of the bill itself. So we have put the language of the bill into the instructions to say if you have farmland that is lawfully qualified under ORS, whatever that section is,
right,
then that qualifies as natural resource property. That value can be excluded from the estate.
And so if I may follow up,
please.
Thank you. Typically with regard to forest land, that forest property will come in and it will be reflected as a single value for the forest land. And so you're not trying to separate out the trees. This is one of the items that Jeff had brought up, was that trees, you know, weren't mentioned, and it was thought that they shouldn't be, that they weren't left out, that they should be part of the exemption. But here, if you've got X amount of dollars for forest land, let's say that I've got an estate of $1 million, and there's or a taxable estate of $1 million. And it includes a piece of forest land of $500,000, which is included. I don't separate out the forest land from the forest trees, do I? I've never seen that done.
Chair, Representative Barnhart, I believe that yes, it should be separated out. On the schedule that we are asking them to complete, we're asking for details,
okay,
assessed values, legal descriptions of the property. So what we should see on that schedule is a separation of those assets. That does not necessarily mean that we would disqualify the trees in the processing of the return. What we're hoping for is guidance from you before we need to do that.
So that, Mr. Chair,
that's why we need a bill.
What's been added here is that additional work is being done by the Department of Revenue to implement it, and then you'll have additional costs by the family of the decedent to come forward to get a cruise report of the timber separated from the actual appraised value of the property that has been included in the death tax return.
Thank you, Representative Butler. And of course, the gist of the upshot of that is that if a small timber lot, tree lot, is the primary asset of the estate, and we keep the definition that's in the law currently, we end up having the result that we were trying to avoid, and that is the cutting of timber, perhaps prematurely, in order to pay the inheritance tax. And of course, that was precisely what we were trying to avoid, and we didn't get there.
I've actually experienced one of those where,
yes,
over in Silverton, Oregon, they had to do a clear cut,
yeah,
of the property in order to pay the death tax.
Yeah, and so that's a thank you. And you've pointed out, I think, very graphically why we need to look at this issue again.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
First of all, I can't resist. This chart says death tax, and some of us would contend that there's no tax on death, because if you die and you don't have any property, you have no tax. The tax is on the estate. So with that, maybe you could say why you refer to
Madam
this
Chair,
the death tax.
I've had that same question in the past when we presented information, and the reason that we did that is perhaps a holdover that we can get rid of now. But Oregon's tax used to be the amount of the state death tax credit allowed for federal purposes, and that is the term that they use, I believe, in order to encompass what various states might term their taxes. So there could be estate taxes, inheritance taxes, beneficiary taxes, taxes on transfer of property, and so on. So I believe the federal government has used that catch-all term, state death tax credit, to encompass all of those different types of taxes. And that is actually the term that is used for federal purposes. We may be able to move on from that since we no longer connect to that state death tax credit.
I think that would be positive, grammatically speaking and substantively. But my question is, you're interpreting this as an exclusion. And the exclusion approach has a much higher revenue impact than the exemption approach. So how far down the road are we? What are you doing? I guess I'm just curious, given all the other problems with this bill, why you're not just putting things on hold.
Madam Chair, in some sense, we are putting things on hold. We did have to implement it because it does apply to deaths that occur in 2007. So we have had to create the form and tell people that this is available. We looked at the language in the bill and did ask the attorneys, what are the plausible interpretations of that language? And the response that came back is, just from the language in the bill, the most reasonable interpretation is that it's an off-the-top exclusion. With that, they did not get into looking at legislative history or listening to testimony to say, well, it's ambiguous enough that there could be another interpretation out there. So we're pretty well stuck with that interpretation at this point. What we are telling people is, if they can put their returns on extension, that probably would be helpful for them and for us. If they do file, then this is what it says in the law, and they can take the best interpretation they have, file the returns, understanding that if you change something and make that retroactive so that it applies to 2007, they may actually owe a bit more tax or have a refund coming.
And Mr. Chair, follow up. Are you informing them of that as well, that this is in conversation and that they may well be subject to a higher tax burden?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we have put in our instructions that we are looking for guidance on these issues and that we will be posting that information on our website as we have updated information. So, yes, we have. And if I could just mention, we have received the first return claiming this exclusion. It was about a $2 million estate, and the value of the natural resource property was less than $500,000 for this particular example. So recognize that if you want to put in a requirement that there be 50% of the property that's qualified, that person might actually owe additional tax should you make that a retroactive change. But we are trying to inform the practitioner community, the attorneys and the CPAs, that there are issues with the bill.
Well, it's not just enough, Mr. Chair, to inform them there are issues. They need to understand that they could be subject to a different tax. I just want to make sure you're being very clear with them on that.
Yes, we are.
Okay. Well, and if I could simply add to that, whether we make a change for 07 or not, it is clear to me that we need to consider changes for the future anyway, because the bill didn't get to where we wanted to go. And it may be that we leave 07 alone and make changes prospectively, perhaps. I mean, I'm not going to prejudge that issue, but that's a possibility. The other thing I would note the issue of the exemption that you were describing cuts one direction, but the issue of the definition of what actually is covered cuts the other. And so an estate that may in fact have relatively low natural resource property under the current definition and a relatively higher a one under a definition that was more inclusive that we thought what we thought we were getting at before. So I think this cuts both directions depending upon the details of the estate. What's your thought about that?
I think you're exactly right, Mr. Chair, that a forest land, for example, if it's predominantly, the value predominantly is land, could see a higher exclusion now, whereas one that has predominant value in the trees is getting very little exclusion if the trees are not included. So you're exactly right. It goes both ways.
Right. And, of course, we have 30-year trees on an area that requires 75 years for a growth cycle. The last thing we want to do is to force the cut of those 30-year trees in order to pay the tax. Yeah. Other questions? Thank you very much.
You.
We really appreciate it. And we have 20 minutes. Do you have other things for us now?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Are we going to take an early lunch break?
Just one thing, yes.
Yeah. And you are?
Douglas Cushing with the law firm of Jordan Schrader Ramos in Portland. And I have been participating in part with Mr. Shane on the bar committee, but also our firm represents the Oregon Association of Nurserymen, a group very interested in this, of course. And I simply wanted to add that there is a significant agriculture group working, the Oregon Farm Bureau and others, that we hope to also participate in this because the consequences of this are significant, one of which that gets lost is the change in the federal tax law now means that 45% of the savings under this law for Oregon get added back to the federal estate tax that estates pay.
Oh,
so it has a if a law of unintended consequences, perhaps, but we appreciate very much the fact that the committees are going to be looking at this for the February session.
So if I may ask, are you suggesting that we consider recapture provision so that the other government doesn't collect money that we'd rather we'd rather have ourselves?
If we could. If we could. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Other questions? Thank you. Well, we appreciate your involvement in that conversation. Anything else for the committee? We do reconvene at 1 o'clock, and Senator Burdick will chair that portion of the meeting until 3 for our two hearings. If there's nothing else, we'll recess for lunch.
In the Senate, in Finance and Revenue Committee.
And the House Revenue Committee.
And our next presentation is on the property tax assessment and collection. And that sounds like a fairly boring subject, but it is really hot because of the... with that introduction, I will ask Karen Gregory to come up and educate us on this. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Chair Bernhardt. It's a pleasure to be here, and property tax is very exciting, so we're going to show you today how exciting it is.
Can you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, for the record, I'm Karen Gregory. I'm the property tax administrator at the Department of Revenue, and with me today is Jim Buchholz, who is the section manager for the Assessment Taxation Standards section within the Department of Revenue. I would like to begin today with a very brief update about a work group that is actually looking at the permanent funding of assessment and taxation. And then Jim's planning on discussing the really meaty and exciting things having to do with Measure 50 and Measure 5 and how all of that works within the property tax system. So my brief little part, I'm going to start with a bit of a backdrop. As all of you know, in the last year, the county budgets have been under immense stress, particularly due to the federal forest funding situation. And I have been before both of your committees at one point or another in the last year talking specifically about that. It really became very clear that many of the counties had to reduce their budgets early, whether they were getting dollars or not. And those dollars, the decisions were incredibly difficult for the counties to make. They've been under stressful situations, and they really needed to balance those budgets. So at the Department of Revenue, obviously, the situation with the federal forest dollar shortage is much larger than simply assessment and taxation. But assessment and taxation, of course, is what we are interested in at the Department of Revenue. And as you know, we're charged with assuring that the county has an adequate assessment and taxation system in the county. And if for some reason the county funds assessment and taxation at a level that's lower than adequate, then there are a number of steps that occur, but at one point the state would need to step in and either make sure that they fund it adequately, and if they are not able to do so, then the state has to take over that function. So why is assessment and taxation so important to the counties? Well, as you know, it's the engine that funds all of local government at all levels. And if the county can't perform that assessment and taxation work adequately over time, all of those local government bodies end up losing the dollars that keep them running, whether it's the rural fire departments, some of the schools, and so on. So solidifying that funding permanently would allow all of those local governments over time to have some stability for their long-term planning. And so because of that, that's really the core concept of a group that has come together. We've called it the Taxing District Property Tax Revenue Stability Review, which is a tremendous mouthful. But some of the associations that are participating in this task group are the Oregon Community College Association, the League of Oregon Cities, Associated Oregon Counties, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, the Oregon School Boards Association, the Special Districts Association, assessors, tax collectors, and then the Department of Revenue is actually facilitating the group, finding the meeting spaces, and providing the staff work to the group. So this group actually met in early October, and at that meeting what they did was have an incredible brainstorm session where it was just a free flow of ideas on how and what elements might be involved in some kind of a permanent funding for assessment and taxation. And they had many items up on the board, and then we honed down that list to come up with about 13 items that all of the members could at least, at a minimal level, agree to. Anything that members could not agree to were taken off that board. So that was our first meeting. The second meeting occurred in November. And at that meeting, the department had done some staff work on those 13 items. We came back together with the group, had a conversation about those items at more in depth, and we're now, the department is going back doing further staff work. The group will come back in December. And basically what they are moving toward, it looks like, is perhaps a package with a number of different ideas that would take a little bit from all of the constituent groups to perhaps find a solution for funding assessment and taxation on a permanent level. There are absolutely no guarantees that we're going to be successful with this. It could be that we won't come to consensus, but all of the indications are that people are really working together. It's a very committed, involved group, and they're really just doing incredible thinking and putting their interests not really aside, because obviously they have their interests, but they're really working together to come up with a solution that each person gives a little bit in order to make the whole perhaps a possibility. So I know that I haven't given you a lot of detail, but I did just want you to know that this group is working, and hopefully by the end of December we'll have something that we might be able to share with the governor's office, legislation, legislative groups such as yourself, and so on. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about that task group. If you don't have any, then Jim can get into the exciting Measure 50 conversation.
Thank you. Senator Monroe.
Did your group discuss the fact that those counties that are potentially hardest hit by the reduction in forest receipts also tend to almost entirely be the counties that have the lowest tax rates, property tax rates? And did you come to any conclusion about how that could be balanced out?
Chair, Senator Monroe, that certainly was a topic that is in discussion. Probably the only way that that would be able to be balanced out is through a referendum at the voter level, because it's in the Constitution. So as far as actually balancing that permanent rate, we're not sure how that might work. We did take a look, though, at perhaps doing some balancing of other funds. I'm not sure that the group is real comfortable with that, but to give you an example, the CAFA grant program that we've talked about in past conversations, we did have some conversation about perhaps doing some kind of a different allocation of that. That would need statutory change and so on. But that really isn't part of where the group tended to go with their 13 options.
And follow up, and some of those counties, Josephine County I'm thinking of in particular, I have relatives that live there, have historically been among the most difficult to get any kind of a property tax measure passed.
Yes.
for any purpose. It's a very, very frustrating problem. And asking those counties where the citizens have been willing to vote for higher property taxes to somehow subsidize those that are unwilling to is a difficult issue as well.
Chair, Senator Monroe, absolutely.
Good questions? Thank you very much, and thank you for
thank
all
you.
Your hard work on this.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, Paul Warner, and for the record, my name is Jim Buholtz. I'm with the Department of Revenue. Paul Warner asked us to come and speak briefly to Measure 50. And what we've done here is we've got a handout, and I'm going to touch on some of the key elements of Measure 50 and then go into some of the issues that we see with Measure 50 10 years after it was passed by the voters. As I said, it was passed by the voters in May of 97, 10 years ago, and it was put into the Constitution. One of the primary elements of Measure 50 was to transform Oregon's property tax system from what was largely a levy-based system prior to Measure 5 to a rate-based system under Measure 50. Prior to Measure 5, the taxing districts would determine the amount that they needed in order to run their operations. They would present that before the voters. The voters would agree to it. And then the dollars that they needed to fund their district operations was spread out ratably over the value of the property within the particular district. When Measure 50 was fully implemented in 1997, one of the key elements was for each of the districts to receive a permanent tax rate. And so rather than being based upon the budgets, the budgetary needs of the particular districts, it now became just a set dollar amount because of the permanent rate that each one of the districts received. And the districts would have to fit their budget within that permanent rate cap. The second and probably the most notorious, or maybe not notorious, but most well-known pieces of Measure 50 is the assessed value growth limit that was placed into effect at the same time. When Measure 50 was put into place in 1997, the assessed values were rolled back to 1995 values minus 10%. That was the 1997 assessed value limit for each of the individual properties, and then each property was allowed to grow 3% per year beyond that. Another element of Measure 50 is that the voters were allowed to approve temporary taxes outside of the permanent rate. So although each one of the districts had a permanent rate, if the voters decided that they agreed with the district that they wanted the district to have more money, then they could approve those through a vote. Two other elements we have here, the next two bullets that we have on the key element overview, they really relate to Measure 5, but they were put in to this element overview because there was an element of Measure 50 that said that nothing in Measure 50 overrides what was in place because of Measure 5, which was passed, I think, in 1990. And so the $5 and $10 limits for schools and for non-schools are still in effect with Measure 50, and just as Measure 5 allowed, voter-approved bonds are not allowed to exceed the Measure 5 limits. Other temporary levies may not, the operating levies.
Wait, you say that again. The bonds can exceed?
The bonds can. I'm sorry. I probably misspoke. The bonds can exceed the Measure 5 limits.
But the other,
operating
the levies
may not.
Yeah,
they're,
yes,
they're to be fit under the Measure 5, $5 and $10 limits. And then the last element that is notable is that new levies may only be approved at a general election with an approval of at least half of the registered voters that are eligible to vote. That's the double majority that we talk about.
Wait a second. The double majority applies at a general election on Measure 50?
No, new levies may only be approved. Oh. We have that wrong there. You're right. You're absolutely right. But, it doesn't apply in a general election. It only applies in off elections. Yes. Good catch.
Right.
I apologize. You're listening.
This is very bad news for a moment there.
Right. And if I may, Madam Chair, there will be a measure on the, I believe it's November 2008 ballot,
yes,
to increase the number of those elections from one every 2 years to four every 2 years,
mm-hmm,
one in May and November of each year, that could be done with a double majority.
Yeah.
So that measure will be on the ballot in 2008 unless the legislature does. Well, I think it's there. It's going to be there.
Yeah, we passed that.
We sent it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, continue.
Terrific. Now, I want to touch on some of the key issues that we see in Measure 50 or that Measure 50 brought us. We've identified five here. First of all, is Measure 50 established predictability. For both local governments and for taxpayers, local governments, the amount of revenue that they have to operate under is really pretty stable. It grows pretty pretty stably through the years. There's no wild fluctuations at all. And then for taxpayers really wanted a predictable property tax, and I would say that Measure 50 did a good job of delivering that for them. Typically, or for most taxpayers, they'll only see a 3% increase in their assessed value from year to year. That would be the maximum. Some taxpayers, we will hear occasionally of some taxpayers receiving higher increases. Most often, that would be because of voter-approved bond levies. Those are added on. So predictability. Along with predictability is the second item that we have here, and that's fewer appeals. The number of appeals prior to Measure 50 was much, much higher than it is today. We don't see very many appeals, and that's because market value of the homes really have very little to do with most properties' property taxes because of the assessed value limit. The third item that we have, the third issue that we wanted to talk about, were what we're calling here unrealistic resource assumptions. And what we're driving at here is that Measure 50, in addition to rolling back the assessed value, set those permanent rates. The permanent rates were set for each one of the taxing districts was largely based upon the levies that were in place at the time Measure 50 came into effect, minus that 10%, and that was locked in. And the reason that's important and why we're calling it an unrealistic resource assumption is that it assumed that all of the revenue streams that existed at the time would continue on into perpetuity. The most probably famous example of this is what Karen was talking about, the federal forest revenues. The federal forest revenues were a portion of, in particular, the Southwest County's revenue streams. And so their permanent rate reflected only the amount that they needed above and beyond the dollars that they were receiving through the federal forest funding stream. When that went away, there was nothing in Measure 50 that allowed for a reset of the permanent rate to backfill those dollars that were lost. And so it assumed that those revenue streams would continue on into perpetuity. The fourth item that we have here are what we've called potentially risky growth assumptions. Measure 50 dealt with growth in two ways. First of all, there was an inflationary growth that was added into Measure 50, and that's the 3% increase that's allowed to happen per year in assessed values. The second growth assumption was what we're calling population and economic growth, and that's new properties that are added into the system, or improvements to existing properties are also allowed to go on the rolls, and so that creates additional tax dollars that probably covers the population and economic growth. The reason why those may be a little risky, we've got four bullets here. First of all, inflation might exceed the 3% cap. So far, we've been pretty fortunate, overall fortunate, in that the general inflation rate is pretty well matched with the 3% growth. We haven't had any particularly wild years of inflation. If we did, then obviously the revenues wouldn't keep pace with with inflation. And second, there are individual commodities that individual districts may be dependent on that have seen increases that don't match up very well with that 3% growth. And I would say that maybe an example of that might be a transportation district. Obviously, the fuel costs have risen much greater than 3%, and so they're not able to recover those additional expenses through the 3% automatic growth. A second risk is that added taxable value may not cover added service demands, and an example of this might be where a new industrial facility is placed in an enterprise zone. The new industrial facility would bring with it increased service demands, and yet there wouldn't be additional dollars that would go to the districts necessarily for that industrial facility. A third risk is the market could shift to a depreciating trend. Now, we haven't seen this so much in Oregon, but across the nation, we have seen markets that had traditionally been increasing in value, in assessed values. Now they're now correcting a bit, and there are there are depreciating trends in some markets across the nation. If that comes to Oregon, then it's possible that the value of the property might decrease, but the costs for the district would not.
Let me ask you on that, because on our tax bills, there's the market value, and then there's the assessed value. So if the market value goes down, how does that affect the assessed value? Because market value can go up indefinitely, and the assessed value will still go up only 3%.
Yes.
So how does it work on the downward?
Well, it's possible that market value could dip below assessed value. And if it does do that, then the assessed value is redlined. It doesn't go up 3% per year.
Oh, I see. So if the market value goes below the assessed value won't go any lower, but it won't go any higher.
Yeah.
It won't go lower, right?
Yeah, Chair Burdick, if the market value of a property drops, typically you're going to see the market value track on a higher slope than the assessed value. But it is possible that the market value might dip below where the assessed value was. If that's true, then the assessed value levels out. It redlines until the market value pops back up and allows the percentage increase.
Okay, thanks.
Madam Chair.
Senator Westland.
Not to take too strong an exception, I want to go back to the risk portion here. Inflation might exceed 3% of cap, and your intimation was that, you know, we've been lucky because CPI has been relatively stable over the last couple of years, and so with the exception of perhaps some certain special types of districts, i.e. transportation, you know, we've kind of dodged that inflation risk bullet. And I would submit to the committee, as well as for discussion, is that no, really, counties have not escaped the inflation risk here, because what counties purchase, local governments purchase, you know, is not a consumer price index related inflator. It's things that are increasing much faster than the general consumer price index. Healthcare, mm-hmm. Energy. You know, none of us behind this dais are out there building prisons or jails or roads. So I do think there's an exposure here that, you know, as we get into our discussions in the session should be more adequately fleshed out.
Thank you for pointing that out.
And Chair Burdick, Senator Westman, I didn't mean to thank you for the correction. I didn't mean to say that everything was hunky-dory. I just
right.
What I was trying to point out is that it wasn't as wild as what it could have been.
It could be worse.
And also, while we're in the elaboration mode here, for the new property and new improvements, aren't those assessed at less than 100%? I mean, when you build a new house, it's worth $500,000. What is the assessed value from day one?
Chair Burdick, that's correct. There is a mathematical computation in Measure 50 that attempts to place the property as if it had been in existence when Measure 50 was enacted, and that is at the same ratio generally, and I'm going to get into that in a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Generally the same ratio as the properties of the same class. The last risk that we have here under our potentially risky growth assumptions is that assessed values frozen in an urban renewal area will not add any additional dollars to those districts, even though the districts may see added service demands for those properties.
May I ask a question?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. I'm looking at these four risks. I think Senator Westland's point is right on. I don't know of any government entities whose costs are increasing at 3% or less. I don't think there are any in Oregon where that's the case. They may be cutting budgets in order to keep within the limits, but if they were actually trying to provide the same service that they had before, they wouldn't be able to do it for this 3%. Added taxable value may not cover added service demands. I think you should change the word may to does not. May not is, I think, much too tame a term, because I don't know of any district where there aren't added service demands that are not covered. The other two items, I think, probably don't fit into those analyses. But the reality is that Measure 50 has been an utter disaster for the property tax, in my opinion. The current trend that we're on Measure 50, is that property tax eventually disappears because the rate in which it grows is lower than the rate of real inflation, which means that mathematically over time it eventually becomes effectively zero. Now, I agree that that will take some time. It will be a while before that actually happens. But we're headed in the wrong direction, and this current trend cannot continue, although the Constitution, as you've pointed out, makes it very clear that the assumptions are that the situation that existed at the time that the measure was adopted will continue forever. An extremely bad assumption. And we've enshrined in the Constitution then a set of assumptions that are simply not true. And I think that it behooves us in government to be sure that we tell people that these assumptions that we've adopted in these measures simply are not true, and that at some point or another the people are going to have to bite the bullet and figure out some other way to finance a local government. Do you have a comment on that, on my comment?
Chair Burdick, Representative Barnhart, I can't disagree with anything you've said.
Thank you.
Me neither, Representative Barnhart. Very well put. Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, and to spin off on the good representative's comments, and what happens, of course, is that if people agree, they can pass serial levies, I think, what, 3-year limit, something like that, in addition to what they're allowed under Measure 50, and so that wealthy districts with voters that are willing to tax themselves higher then can provide services, whereas the poorer districts where the voters are unable or unwilling to tax themselves more end up with a declining service level, bringing about much greater inequities across the state than we had prior to Measure 50.
Thank you. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Hurry.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. The last issue that we wanted to touch on were some of the inequities that were created by Measure 50 that are inherent in Measure 50. And I think it's fair to say that Measure 50 essentially exchanged equity for predictability. Voters wanted predictability, and they got it with Measure 50, but in some cases they sacrificed equity for that. And we've identified three primary scenarios of inequity in Measure 50. First we call pocket appreciation, and if you've read the Willamette Week article of a few weeks ago, this is the issue that was raised there. The second is the changed property ratio for new properties. There's an inequity that is created there, an inequity that is created there. And then finally, the arbitrary 1995 appraisal baseline. We've got some examples of each in the handout that we gave you. In the issue around pocket appreciation, the Willamette Week article, the way that this particular inequity is created is when you have two different properties that had quite a difference in market value when Measure 50 was enacted back in 1997. If you recall what I had said, Measure 50 rolled back assessed values to the 1995 assessed value minus 10%, and that set the baseline for the assessed value.
Excuse me, what is that, Paul?
It's called a contract.
Okay. Oh, can you make it stop? Can somebody make a call and make it stop? Okay, thanks. Table's vibrating.
Madam Chair, I think it's a deflationary event.
I think Bill Sizemore is running the jackhammer over here. All right, go ahead. We stopped it.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Let me back up a little bit and set this example up a little bit again. This particular inequity is created when you have two properties in two different neighborhoods that start out with a difference in assessed value, but one of them appreciates over time much quicker than the other. So in the Willamette Week article, we had a property in Northeast Portland and a property in Southeast Portland. The property in Northeast Portland started out with a lower market value than the property in Southwest Portland. The property in Southwest Portland was much higher. But the property in Northeast Portland appreciated much quicker than the property in Southwest Portland. Because Measure 50 doesn't look at the market value of a property once the maximum assessed value is set, then all the appreciation that happens in the house in Northeast Portland to the point where it becomes equal to the home in Southwest Portland, the assessed value or the maximum assessed values don't reflect the differences in the appreciation and value of those homes. So the property in Northeast Portland started out with a much lower maximum assessed value than the property in Southwest Portland. Both were allowed to track at 3% per year. But once the assessed values of those two properties equaled in 2007, the difference in those maximum assessed values really became very clear that in our example, the house that started out with $100,000 assessed value, or excuse me, market value, and the one that started out with a $200,000 market value, because of Measure 50, they have the very different maximum assessed values.
Well, and it was made worse too because by Measure 5 required fully assessed residential property, which had not been done in Oregon before Measure 5. I mean, residential property, I think statewide, I certainly know in my county, was very underassessed. Mm-hmm. So when the full assessments went up, then the more valuable, you know, property-wise neighborhoods got much big jump in assessments. I happen to live in Southwest mm-hmm. Portland and got almost no tax relief from Measure 5 because of the reassessment. So the neighborhoods that were reassessed early took a hit at the time, and that it continued on through the Measure 50. That high assessment continued to dog them.
Chair Burdick, I think you pretty well described example three that we have here. And I'll walk through in a minute.
Okay.
That's the first example. The second example that we have of an inequity that was created by Measure 5, or what we're calling new properties in the CPR. For new property, as we discussed earlier, new property was allowed to go on the rolls. It is taxable. But Measure 50, a mechanism in Measure 50, tries to determine what the assessed value of that property would have been had it existed in 1997, when Measure 50 came into place. That adjustment is known as the change property ratio, or CPR. In our example here, we have the same two neighborhoods that we had in example one, where you have the average price for both neighborhoods now is at around $285,000, but you can see they have very different taxable values because of the appreciation that's happened through time in the two neighborhoods. When you build a new home in those neighborhoods, you can build a home right next door to one of the existing properties. The value can be exactly the same as the property right next door to it, but because the change property ratio, or the ratio that's applied to try to place that property as if it had existed when Measure 50 was put into place, because that ratio is a countywide ratio, it takes into account neighborhoods that have high appreciation and neighborhoods that have low appreciation, and it's a blend of all of that. And so if you, in our neighborhood A, where it's a home that is built in a rapidly appreciating neighborhood, the light blue shows that the ratio of assessed value to market value is 64%, and that brand new home gets an assessed value of $181,500. But you can see that the house in the dark blue, which it's right next door to, has an assessed value of $121,000. The opposite is true now for those neighborhoods that had that didn't appreciate so rapidly, because they benefit from the appreciation that's happened in the other neighborhoods that was much more accelerated than the neighborhood that they were in, because they use that blended rate. And so a brand new home that's built in that neighborhood that hasn't appreciated quite so rapidly, even though the market values of the two homes are identical, the assessed value is going to be quite a bit lower in that new home than it will be for the home that the neighbors own.
Now, tell me why that is in an area where the... Oh, I see. I see. Never mind. Go ahead. Everybody else get that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. I guess I'm just slow. Okay, go ahead. Representative Berger?
I think so, too. Yeah. Just to pursue this just a moment, the county residential CPR is something that's determined individually by the counties doing an averaging process, and is it done the same county by county?
Chair Burdick, Representative Berger, yes, it's done same county by county, but it's or county to county, but within each county it only includes the properties that exist within that county.
Exactly.
So it's not the CPR in Wheeler County is not impacted by what happens in the Multnomah County area.
I just want to be clear that each county then does this function in the same way, so there's not inequities in how it's measured between counties. The measurement will be different depending on the county profile, but the actual mechanism that the county clerks or the county assessors use is the same.
Chair Burdick, Representative Berger, yes. Each county sets its own change property ratio by property class within that county. So the properties on the east side of the county will receive the same change property ratio for residential as the ones on the west side.
And the county clerk or the county assessor in Wheeler County uses the same method for calculating as the county assessor in Multnomah County uses.
Chair Burdick, Representative Berger, you've been very patient with me. The answer is yes.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. The final example that we have of inequity is what we're calling the arbitrary nature of the 1995 appraisal baseline, and I think, Chair Burdick, you referenced this. Prior to Measure 50, counties were on what we called a six-year cycle. And what that meant was that a sixth of the county would get reappraised every year, so that eventually every 6 years each property would get reappraised. In the intervening years, the county would trend the values of that property as a proxy for the reappraisal that happened in that sixth year. Depending on where a property might have been in that six-year cycle, the properties could have a difference in their maximum assessed value, because the maximum assessed value didn't look at where that property was in that particular cycle. So in our particular example that we've drawn here, the home that exists in neighborhood C, we're saying was reappraised in 1995. So the homes that we have here are really identical in every respect, except they're in different neighborhoods. One of the neighborhoods got reappraised and the other one didn't. The home in neighborhood C got reappraised and the value got bumped up to $125,000 because the assessor saw that there were that they hadn't trended it exactly right to match it up with market in the intervening years. And so they bumped it up to $125,000, just like they should have, because the home was worth $125,000. And so the maximum assessed value for that particular property was set based on that $125,000. The home in neighborhood D identical in every respect. It just hadn't been reappraised, so it was still at the lower value. The assessor hadn't caught up yet with that particular home, and so the value was still at the $100,000 that the home in neighborhood C was prior to the reappraisal. And because it hadn't been reappraised, then Measure 50 said use that value that was in place in 1995, and it got locked in with a maximum assessed value that is much lower than the other property. And so even though the properties are the same in every respect, the property in Neighborhood D got a lower maximum assessed value that tracks even through today. That's all of the examples we had and all of the issues. I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have.
I guess the fundamental question is, what do we do about this? I mean, you know what? It just seems like if you take one course of action, then you're creating other inequities. I mean, how do other states do this, other property tax states? California, why don't you tell us about California? Not that that's any great shiny example, but it is an example of a state that has done a property tax limitation.
Chair Brady, California with their Proposition 13, the main difference between California and Oregon is that, or at least the main difference that spoke about, is that when a property sells in California, the assessed value limitation gets reset. It gets reset to market value. But you hit the nail on the head. We could adopt something like that in Oregon. Of course, it would take a constitutional change, but we could adopt something like that in Oregon. But we'd really just be trading one set of inequities for another. If we did that, and we see this in California, that you have homes that are right next door to each other that have very different assessed values. Even though they're receiving the same services, one home is paying much less for the services than another home simply because of the time in which it sold.
And I know you're not a lawyer, but has anyone from your end of things looked into the legalities of having this different unequal taxation for like-situated parties?
Senator Burdick, there is a provision in the Constitution that says that the property tax, in essence, the property tax system has to be inequitable for like properties.
Has to be equitable
for like property. Did I say inequitable?
Yes, you did. And that's in our state constitution?
That's in our state constitution, but also one of the provisions of Measure 50 was that particular clause in the Constitution did not apply to Measure 50. So Measure 50 was exempted from that.
But there's other constitutional provisions like the federal constitution, the 14th Amendment, with equal protections, where you have bigger equality concepts that might apply. Has anyone looked into this?
Senator Burdick, I know, not that I know of. I assume there have been, but I don't know. And you're right, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't even play one on TV.
I played one on judiciary for 4 years. Stop laughing, Representative Barton.
And not very well. I mean,
I knew someone had to say that. All right, any other questions or comments? This is a very good job, you guys. This is good information to have. I have no idea what we're going to do about this.
Yeah.
We have a serious problem here. So thank you very much. Any other parting comments? Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Okay. Boy, we're just zooming through our agenda here. Representative Barnhart, did you want to take the next section here?
Update on interim studies?
Yeah.
Do we, Mary, tell me what we have on this.
I think Paul, you have something to report on that?
Paul's going to report.
We'll
okay.
Change staff here.
Okay. We're running ahead of our agenda, and if we are successful in doing that, we'll be able to go home early.
For the record, I would like to thank whoever stopped the noise. Thank you very much. You were very persuasive.
Sorry, constructive reasons.
Yeah, when we're behind schedule, the
construction credit is an added cost.
Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have, at the end of your agenda, two interim studies that you assigned to us during the regular session, and we certainly appreciate that. The first one is a study on small schools, and Steve is working on that, and he's going to update you on where he is. The bill is House Bill 2040, and he was to submit a study to the 2009 legislature. So Steve is going to kind of update you on where he is on that, and he's been kind of outlining that process.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members, for the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. You have a handout, three-page handout, that I'll be referring to in terms of talking about the small school funding. I wanted to first go over the legislation so that you would be have your memory refreshed in terms of what was in the legislation, what it requires, talk a little bit about what's being done and what might be done to comply with that, and then show you, talk a little bit about current law and show you a couple of graphs that illustrate current law. On that first page, labeled House Bill 2040, I wanted to call your attention to Section 10. This is the legislation language that requires that the interim committees conduct a study on the adequacy of funding small school districts and small education service districts. In any prior studies that I'm aware of, education service districts were not part of it. It was just dealt strictly with small schools and small school districts. So this is a new wrinkle to the legislation to include small ESDs. There's four items there that are to be considered. One is the relationship between small school districts and education service districts. Another is whether the funding is adequate for the small school districts, and the legislation refers to the two sources of additional funding now, the extra small school weights in the school equalization formula, and also the funding outside the formula, the $2.5 million that goes just to small high schools, districts with small high schools. So considering those two sources, are they adequate for small schools? Also, what types of small school districts are not being provided adequate funding? This, I think, leaves an opening to perhaps group small schools separately. Maybe there's a certain set of small schools with certain characteristics that require additional funding. Maybe other small schools are adequately funded under the current system. But at least being able to divide them up and not necessarily deal with them as a whole group. And then also the long-term effects of not providing small school districts and education service districts with adequate funding. I'm not sure how that will be dealt with, but some comments can be made. And then, of course, as with any study, you are to make recommendations and perhaps pre-file some proposed legislation based upon the results of the study. Note also that there's no funding included for this study. So it's whatever can be done free of charge and in-house, I guess. The two key components seem to be basically what is small, is the current definition of small adequate or should it be changed, and then what is adequate in terms of funding for small schools compared to larger school districts. And those will, I think, be the two difficult issues to deal with. The one small study, prior study that you may be aware of is the 2002 study by the Department of Education on the cost of operating small schools in Oregon. And that can be distributed at some point if we want to refer to that study. I am currently working on a research report that will talk about current law, give some illustrations, include the graphs that you have here this afternoon. I will also have a section on the history of small school legislation, give you some sense of how that's changed over time. And then I also want to have some data there on the school districts that currently qualify and the amount of their weight in the formula, and also the individual schools then that generate that extra weight for those school districts. But that didn't quite get completed. Before going into the school component, I just want to mention that also in 2040, and it's in section 7B, if you want to look at it towards the top of the page, the first dark print, that's what the legislature did for small ESDs this last session. It set a minimum funding level of $1 million per ESD. It had been a little under $950,000. It was raised to $1 million. And there's five ESDs that currently qualify for that. What that has done is to give those five ESDs that qualify about twice as much funding on a per-weighted student basis as the other ESDs. So kind of comparable treatment or same kind of approach in a different way as for small school districts and small schools. Okay, if you would turn to the second page, then the outline basically of current law, just to refresh our memories in terms of what it takes to qualify and a little bit in terms of the magnitude of the weight. The school size for elementary schools has to be less than an average of 28 students per grade. So if you're looking at an 8th grade elementary school, it cannot exceed 224 students. If it were a 4th grade elementary school, it couldn't exceed 112, half that amount. For high schools, for a 4th grade high school, it has to be less than an average of about 87 students per grade, or 350 for the school as a whole. Those have been in place since about 1995. The legislation that was adopted in 95 is pretty much intact. There have been some small changes, but not much. The school distance requirement for elementary has to be at least 8 or more miles to the nearest elementary school. And for elementary schools, there's three categories that you can put them in. One is that they are not remote, consequently don't qualify. The other one is if they're between 8 miles and 12 miles to the nearest school, they are partially remote, or what I call partially remote. They qualify, but they don't qualify for the full additional weight. And then those that are beyond the 12 miles qualify for the full additional weight. There was similar legislation that applied to high schools, that if they were between 10 and 20 miles, they were partially remote and would get part of the additional weight, but that was removed with 99 legislation and took full effect in 05-06. So high schools are not affected by the distance requirement. Location, there can't be any change in the location since January of 95. That applies to both elementary and high schools. Also, there had to be a prior small school qualification as of July 18th, 95 for elementary schools and October 23rd of 99 for high schools. The 99 date is different because there was legislation that affected high schools at that time that did not affect elementary schools, and so that date was made current at that time. There's a waiver process where the superintendent can waive the couple of the qualifications under exceptional circumstances. I don't know if that applies to any schools right now or not, but it's been used at all.
I'm not sure who's running the meeting at this point. Representative, please, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Kelster.
This is the state superintendent, not the local superintendent.
State superintendent.
And then in terms of the location and prior qualification for exceptional circumstances, can that include the distance between the school and another school? Or is that only what's in the top chart?
I'm sorry, I don't think I'm understanding the question.
Are you saying I asked an unclear question? I can't even imagine. Amazing. Does the state superintendent of schools under current law have the authority to waive the requirement of a school being less than 8 miles to the nearest elementary school. And the reason I ask this question, we had a bill about this last session. We do have some schools in the state that are ineligible for the small school fund because they are just under less than 8 miles from the nearest school, but that nearest school is not in the same school district. So those kids don't actually have the option of going to the school that is less than 8 miles away. Do we need a bill, or can the superintendent waive that requirement and make it only so that it's a school within the same school district?
Chair Burt, Representative Gelser. The waiver only applies to the location and prior qualification. It does not apply to distance.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Then for the calculation itself, I didn't want to bring the formula to you today. A little too soon for that. But
I think that's an accurate assessment.
There is a minimum number of students that is used in the calculation for elementary schools. It's 25 students minimum. So even if it has a school of 10 students in the formula, you still use 25. For high schools, that number is 60. Even though but don't get the idea that if you use that number, that's the number that's also been funded. It's not. You put that number in the formula, and the number that comes out in terms of additional weights will be less than that number. For elementary schools, for an 8th grade elementary school, for example, that 25 students going in would only generate about 25 additional weighted students that are funded. And for high schools, that 60 would generate about 50 additional weighted students to be funded. The additional weights vary by school size and number of grades. It gives you an idea of the maximum amount there for the 25 ADM, and it can go up to 56 for an 8th grade elementary school at 112. And that's illustrated at the charts. Maybe it would just be best to go to the chart. The top chart, titled Small School Added Student Weight, gives the total added weight by school size. The horizontal portions of those lines to the left is what's generated by the minimum. Right? So you can see there, even though you're using 60, the additional ADM for the high school line is only at 50. And same way for the grade schools. So once you get beyond the horizontal line, it starts to peak. It peaks at half for high schools, for example, at the halfway point. Half of 350 is 175. For the 8th grade elementary school, it would peak at 112, half of the 224 maximum. And then after that, it tapers down to zero as the school size approaches the maximum size limit. For the high school, that peak added student weight is about 89. For the 8th grade elementary school, it peaks at about 56. Okay. Then the chart below that is just taking that total added weight and saying, what is that total added weight on a per-student basis? So then you get the shape of the curve that starts out relatively high for very small schools and then drops rather quickly and then tapers out gradually as you approach the limit for that school. So for the 4th grade high school, eventually at the 60 students, it drops rather quickly to that and then tapers down to zero at 350, and the same for the other grades. Now, note here that on this chart for the elementary schools, there's no adjustment here for the distance. This assumes that they are fully remote. If you were taking into a distance adjustment, then that line would be even lower on the chart. The distance adjustment is on a mileage basis, so that for the elementary school, if it's between that 8 and 12 mile partially remote range, if it's halfway between, if it's at 10 miles, then it qualifies for half of the additional weight. And it's prorated like that.
Senator Burdick.
This remoteness, you got the elementary school. Who's 10 miles away or 12 miles away? Is it every student? Is it half the students?
No, the next nearest elementary school has to be that distance away.
Oh, I see. Okay, got it. Thanks.
So arguendo, your student might be, the furthest away student might only be 4 miles away.
Or it could be further than that in a different direction.
Correct.
Madam Chair.
He's in charge.
He'll get really
mad
if I take over.
No, I won't.
I definitely wouldn't want to make Chair Breyer.
Not at this time of the day.
On this issue of the remoteness, this has troubled me for a while, and I met with a small school superintendent recently, and he brought me an example of a pair of these schools. And his high school qualifies for the remote part, but his elementary school doesn't because it's close to a school in another district. And the difference, he compared it to a comparable community just because of that fractional difference in the distance. That other community got 42.2 additional ADMW while he gets nothing, even though his school is smaller to start with. And that somehow that doesn't make any sense. It seems like the formula should be weighted according to bringing the resources in to meet the kids rather than what's happening in the next school district over.
Do you have a comment on that one?
Chair Barnhart, maybe that's one of those I shouldn't answer too. That's something, that's the way it works now. There probably were reasons for that at the time. That may have had something to do with trying to encourage mergers, consolidations of schools, if not school districts. So there's some history behind that that I'm not totally familiar with.
And it seems like it would have had to have been the school districts, because these are issues not of another elementary school in that same district, but actually over a district line where that student couldn't enroll in that other school district.
Yes.
Because they're not a resident member of that district. Transportation wouldn't be provided.
Right. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Steve, members of the committee, I'm lost. Your third page?
Yes.
This looks to me like a paragraph that only an economist would appreciate. And I am not, and I've never played one on TV.
Neither have I.
Well, would you explain to me, Steve, what I'm looking at here in terms that I can understand? I'm sorry. I just looked at it, and it's meaningless to me. And if you can describe it without the graph, it would be even better.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I was hoping the graph would be easier than trying to do it verbally.
You just lost me. I was going along, and I was with you, and then, boom, I dropped off.
And I was also hoping to be short enough that you wouldn't realize you were bored until I was already done.
No, we were bored when you sat down.
But what the top graph is trying to illustrate is what are the numbers generated from the formula that applies in calculating the additional weight?
Okay, can I pursue this so that I
Please.
Can go baby steps through
Absolutely.
This?
Absolutely. It may be beneficial for other members as well.
Am I the only one who's walked off the map? So basically what it's illustrating is divided by high schools, grade school, and four grade ES.
Elementary school.
Four grade. When you start out, it's how much the formula says they would get, and then what's that big loop thing?
Each of the loops is for a
school. Just take the high school. Let's just go with one.
Okay.
I can get it for one, I can get it for the others.
All right. The high school graph is saying that if you have 25 students in your high school, okay, you get 50 additional weighted students in the formula.
Okay.
If you have 175 students in the middle and you go up to the fourth grade high school line,
you get
89 additional weighted students for that size high school.
And into the formula?
In the formula.
As currently constituted?
Yes.
Now I'm lost. Okay. Wait a minute. Let me see if I can get with him before I... Madam Chair, engage me because I think I'm getting there. So, okay. So then it loops back down because at the end you connect with whatever the formula is as if you weren't a small high school.
Right. At 350, you are no longer a small high school. So you get no additional small school weight.
So if I could conclude from this, the formula as we currently do it gives you something extra if you're in the middle or the low end or of students for a small high school. But if you're at the high end of students for a small high school, you're getting less and less and less and less.
Correct. Basically, that's what the bottom chart is telling you. As that size of school grows, the additional weight declines. There's an inverse relationship between the two. As the student number of students and the size of the school increases, the amount of the additional weight in the formula decreases.
Okay, so the important question then is, how many schools are represented here? Are we talking about 10 schools or 100 schools within the state?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, we're talking about 126 school districts. I don't have the data completed yet. I think that's about what it is, and roughly 190 schools, depending upon how you count schools that were the elementary school and high schools in the same building.
So it's a significant number.
Yes.
Thank you.
And
I think I get it.
No, I did it because I thought you said 75 when you were saying 175, and once I figured that out, then the whole thing makes sense.
Yeah, it works.
Good.
One follow-up question on this. Of the students in the state, do you know what percentage of the students in the state attend one of these schools that qualifies for the small school added student weight?
Mr. Chair, I think, again, I don't have an exact number. I haven't done the numbers yet, but I think it's less than maybe 2 or 3% of the total are in small schools.
So we have 120 school districts? 126 school districts who have only 3% of the total student body in the state?
No, in small schools.
126 school districts have some of their schools or all of their schools that are small schools. And in those small schools, 3% of our total student body goes to school.
I think that's roughly correct.
Okay. I mean, this is important for us to keep in mind. We have 199 school districts. 198 school districts. But three-quarters of our students, or thereabouts, are represented by 15 or 20 school districts. Isn't that accurate? And most of those that do not have any small schools under this formula.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll have that distribution for you eventually.
Later. All right. Go ahead. And I know you had some other things you want to talk about. Yes, Representative Gelson.
One more question. On the chart, it breaks down four-grade elementary school, eight-grade elementary school, four-grade high school. Living with a middle schooler, I know they're challenging, but are there no small middle schools?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelson, yes, there are. Yes, there are. All of the high schools, as far as I know, are four-grade high schools. Typically, you'll have some districts with grades 1 to 6, and then 7 and 8 may be part of the high school or at the same location. So there's a wide variety of grade combinations.
So there's not an allocation for a traditional middle school, 6, 7, 8?
Not separately. It would be by the number of grades in that middle school. The formula works by number of grades. Right? So it could have 4 grades, could have 6 grades, could have 7 grades, it could have 2 grades. The formula will still apply based on the number of students and number of grades.
You're going to allow twice as many students in a 4-grade school as you will in a 2-grade school. Just because of the way the formula works.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But if you're a 3-grade school, you're not eligible. You have to be a 4-grade or an 8-grade.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, you can be any number of grades as long as you have, on average, of less than 28 students per grade.
Okay.
So in the statute, you have a number of students associated with a 1-grade school, a 2-grade school, a 3-grade school, so on, in terms of setting that limit. And it works out to be an average of 28 that generates the limit.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I I think I've reached past the boredom stage. Just a couple of closing comments in terms of what I hope to do. I think sometime before the supplemental session is to get together with the proponents of the amendment and try to talk through what they kind of expect this legislation to generate, and come up with a plan, and then bring that back to you for your review. And then also learn from you what kind of information you would like to have to perhaps base a decision on, so that that's all available. And then maybe in the supplemental session you'll want to take some public testimony to help further direct what work should be done then in the rest of the interim.
Thank you. I have just two comments, and one of them is a direct response to Representative Gelser's question, and that is that the allocation of funds to school districts is a profoundly political kind of decision. And it's based on, and I don't mean this to be funny, although it may sound that way, it's based on trying to understand what the needs of the students are in differently configured schools. I've learned, having represented a district with only large schools, and then representing a district with some small schools, some rural schools, and also some large schools, that the effects of budget shortfalls are very different on the different schools based on the way in which they can respond to these budget shortfalls. We have been in a budget shortfall situation since about 1993. And of course that seems normal to many people now because it's gone on for such a long time. But that means that the allocation of inadequate resources to different configurations of schools and schools in different parts of the state with different needs becomes a profoundly political conversation, and one in which we have to do our job, to do our darndest to get every student as close as we can to the best education that the state is actually able or willing to afford. And I think that's what this conversation is about, and I appreciate the work you're doing on it. My last comment on this section, and really is in response to what you said, one of the things that I'm hoping the House Revenue Committee will do during the February session is that we will hold a number of meetings which are essentially interim committee meetings, which will not be directed at testimony or action on bills that we're considering in the February session, but although we'll do that too, but are directed instead at interim work for things that will come up in 09. And I appreciate the fact that you will be prepared in February to give us a more complete report. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Witt.
In addition to trying to bring academic excellence to each one of the students in these school districts, I think it's incumbent upon the ESDs to make sure that whether they are large districts or small, that they provide adequate, decent, and affordable health care to their employees. And I would comment specifically that ESDs that require their custodial staff, their food preparers, those kinds of folks who are typically low-paid workers, to be paying 27% of their take-home pay for health care expenses is inappropriate. And I will be judging future budgetary requests by some of those ESDs on that basis.
Fair warning. Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much. Enterprise zones. Paul?
Chair, I'll ask Mary to come up because she's working on this more than me. But I have a kind of a summary page for you that's Senate Bill 151, an implementation of study. So I just thought I would update the committee on kind of where we are, the committees. First of all, I did have an opportunity to go through this along with the Economic Development Department with Representative Witt's committee, Workforce and Economic Development Committee, in October. So we've kind of walked through this, and I've got some input from that I'll refer to. But as you recall, Senate Bill 151, it was the bill that extended the sunset on the enterprise zones, allowing tax exemptions through a local sponsor on property taxes for particular zones to encourage economic development. What the bill does is extend that sunset, but it also puts in a requirement for a study to go forth. And one of the things that the House Revenue Committee kind of wrestled with during the session was how to lay out that study in a way that would ensure that the legislature got the information they were interested in and gave proper direction to the Economic Development Department and ensured some objectivity to the analysis. So this is what we've tried to do, is in cooperation with the department, set up a process that will hopefully address the questions that you're concerned about. And basically, the Economic Development Department, through the work primarily of Art Fish, who's here, has gathered data over the years of implementation of the program, and has built a database that from the sponsors, and we've had an extensive enough time period to look at that data. And that database we see is the key to conducting a cost-benefit analysis, which is required in Senate Bill 151. We want to look at and give the department's guidance on looking at measures for local economic hardship before and after policy implementation. We're looking at really the effectiveness of this policy tool toward economic development. And what we've done is try to set up a process that will do that, and since the Legislative Revenue Office has been given kind of the overall responsibility for the study, my thoughts on this and giving you the kind of information you're seeking is for us to form and chair a study review team. Those of you that have been in the transportation process, the cost allocation studies, kind of a model like that, in which Department of Transportation has the information on cost allocation, the vehicle miles traveled by the various vehicle types, and so forth. But there's DAS through the State Economist's Office sets up a study review team that has interested parties and reviews that work and provides research questions and comments on methodology and reviews the results. So that's the kind of model that we're trying to set up here. And we've worked toward doing that. And what I envision as a output for the committees is a report from the department that they prepare with input and review from the review team, and then a separate, I call it a critique here, but a separate document or memo from the review team itself, talking about those areas where the comments the review team would make and emphasizing things that we think possibly could be done in the future or areas where we think conclusions may or not be able to be drawn and maybe we can work on some methodologies in the future to improve that. So that's kind of the format. We have had one meeting with our review team, and actually some of our review team, distinguished review team members, are here. So we've gotten input from Art Air from the Employment Department. Art has the employment data that we need to really assess the enterprise zones. John Hart from Department of Revenue has access to the property tax data, which is, of course, another key element to that. And Tony Ruffalo, who's done a fair amount of work at Portland State on the impact of enterprise zones, is also helping us. Tony's been looking at this issue for a long time. And then we have the various organizations, AOC, LOC, and the special districts providing input as well. So that's kind of the way we're set up on this. We did, as I said earlier, meet with the Workforce and Economic Development Committee. On the back side of your sheet was kind of some comments we got from them, and we're adding these as kind of guidance as we go forward, talking about some of the objectives of the enterprise zone policy, making sure that we don't just include jobs but also wages or overall income effects, take a look at longer term impacts, looking at particular impact on local budgets, for example, service demands as well as revenue impacts, and try to do some comparisons that would give us kind of while we can never get to a causal kind of relationship, to give us some comparisons that would look at kind of with and without kind of criteria to give us a sense of give us a better idea of the effect of the tool itself in the economic environment. We have had one meeting with the review team. Our plan now is Mary has developed some research questions with the review team that they've commented on, and our plan is to, at our next meeting, to meet with the Economic Development Department folks, go through those research questions and ask for their guidance and begin to put the data together. The report is due in for you in the 2009 session, but we hope to be able to update you as we go through. And we want to make sure that we address, or at least try to address, the questions that you want answered for your policy decisions.
Any questions? Mr. Chair? Mary Ayala, Legislative Revenue Office. Did you want me to add to that?
Sure.
Okay. In the process of working with the work group that Paul just described, I sent out a memorandum to them highlighting some of the issues that I had researched from some studies that have been done previously, one of which is very good, a California study, and suggested certain types of analyses that have been done in other states, and then ask them to comment so that what we do end up with is a set of suggestions that deals with broad topics as opposed to a fine, let's say, set of data requirements that we want. We would like to see if we can cover a lot of different bases, and maybe we won't be able to, with the current database, we may not be able to get to a lot of the answers that we'd like to get to, but there may be some opportunities to suggest restructuring the database to be able to handle more types of analyses. Some of the suggestions that I've heard so far have dealt with dealing with comparative analyses across comparable areas. What's going on in an enterprise zone similar to what's going into a comparable geographic area that is not designated as such? Do we see the same, let's say, low-income characteristics, low-wage, low-income, however you want to define it for categorizing an enterprise zone with regard to eligibility? Can we say over a period of time that it's outperformed in other area? Can another issue that wouldn't be able to be addressed with current data, but we might be able to suggest long-term a process for evaluating whether or not the incentives in an urban area are working as well for a rural area? We might also be able to address sometime in the future whether or not companies in an enterprise zone that are there before it's designated as such receive enough assistance or whatever to keep them there. Or over time, if you did a longitudinal study on all the companies, which is possible to do, by the way, if all the companies within an enterprise zone are actually improving over time, or is the net change in employment and wage not changing any more than non-enterprise zone area? So all of these issues have been discussed lightly by the work group, and what we need, I think the work group will do at the next meeting, will start to refine the priorities that they have that they want to talk to the department about. I think that's it. Do you have any questions?
I do have one, and what you're basically describing is what I, in the social sciences, we would talk about as a control group versus a group based in which you're doing your impact, whatever that is, the experimental group. The question I have is I'm assuming you're still exploring how to set these things up. But of course, the key issue is, can you actually get comparable areas within which to make your comparison? And I assume that you know that, and that's one of the complexities around a study of the kind you're trying to do.
That is correct, Chair.
Thank you. Other questions, comments, thoughts? Go and do well.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, we certainly do appreciate these assignments to keep us being idle during the
Well, we certainly wouldn't want you to be bored. That's right. Thank you. Paul, is there other business to come before the committee, or other members while we're here? The business to come before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I think we've completed the agenda. Just a reminder, we will need to
have a meeting prior to the February session, at least one meeting for form of bill introduction. We've had the bill draft request process now, and so those bill drafts should be available in January, and so that will go through the normal process that we would go through in a pre-session file bill for the February session. So we'll actually get the language on that. So we'll have to meet prior to that.
Thank you, and thank you. That, of course, was the point I was trying to make a little bit earlier. We don't have, in the Senate, of course, has met formally several times for appointments and other things, and they've had a chance to adopt rules that apply for the February session, I believe. The House has not met since June and does not have rules adopted for the February session. So what we're doing, basically, is following the leadership, including conversations with between the Speaker, the majority and minority leaders, and other members of the leadership in the House as we sort of feel our way along. But I think the plan at this moment, at least, is that we will get drafts from Legislative Council in late December, early January, and we will want to meet pretty quickly after that, allow members to prepare amendments that they would like to see for those legislative council drafts. The Senate may, in fact, have some kind of a pre-session filing rule that I simply don't know. But the House does not, and that means that the House will, assuming that we follow the schedule we currently have, will convene sometime early February, will adopt rules for the February session, and presumably those rules will allow committees to immediately introduce the bills that we've been working on. The Speaker will assign them immediately back to whatever committees are appropriate. Of course, the committee that introduced the bill may not be the first one to see it. If the Betsy bill, for example, that we've been talking about, may in fact go to Energy and Environment Committee first. But what that means is that we need to go through the regular process of hearing amendment, or at least amendment consideration, engrossment of bills before we actually have a bill as such in the House. Because we won't have a bill as such until the first part of February after the session starts. But we're going to act in January as though that's what we're doing, so that we can get to the point where we have a bill for the House to vote on sometime late in the first week. Otherwise, we cannot get finished in February. That's sort of what we are. So what would be helpful, I think, for Paul and for me is for people to keep their powder dry for January after the first of the year, so that the committee can meet on relatively short notice. And I'm thinking we may need two meetings, even if we plan them well, in order to do all of that. I promise that I will keep you informed about where we are so that we can get Legislative Council drafts back to you, so that if you have comments and criticism about them, we can work on those expeditiously at our January meetings. Representative Berger.
This is a fundamental question, Mr. Chair, but it was my understanding that each committee would have the ability to enter one bill.
Correct.
And so only one. You keep saying bills, and
well,
I'm going.
Well, what happened?
But this committee only has one bill.
What happened before you arrived today was that the committee on motions made by Representative Butler agreed that it will introduce a bill to try to work on the clarifications needed on the Natural Resources Property Inheritance Tax.
I kind of understood that, but that.
And then we've also asked the Rules Committee to introduce additional bills on other topics. The Betsy Manufacturing Clarification Bill, a possible bill on the Education Stability Fund, and what was the third one?
Reconnect.
And a potential reconnect bill in the event that, because of constitutional issues, the Senate bill doesn't get us there. And that's purely defensive at this point, because we don't know what Congress is going to pass. Those three things. Now, we don't know whether the Rules Committee is going to introduce those bills for us or not. But that is the safety. That is the safety mechanism.
Rules, so I'll find out for you.
That is the safety mechanism. I did ask leadership to allow us to introduce more than one bill in this committee, as well as in Ways and Means, and they basically said no. That it should be run through the Rules Committee. So that's what we're going to do.
Okay. Thank you.
And that committee, of course, meets next week. Yeah. Any other comments for the good of the order?
Let me just have a couple of other dates, just so people are aware. We have discussed with the economic forecasters, Dave Eck and Michael Kennedy, about moving up the normal March forecast, and right now we're looking at probably a February 8th as a release on that. That's tentative at this point, but that would be the first week of the session. So you would have an updated forecast for the February session rather than have that come out on the last day.
So we may have another joint meeting in February.
We may have another joint meeting in that first Friday of the supplemental session. The other thing I just wanted to mention, I know both chairs are on the task force, but and Representative Reed is on the task force on revenue restructuring. Will have its first meeting next week. So, and Representative Bruin's on it too. So on Thursday. So that's kind of moving along in parallel to the committee work.
Mm-hmm. Great. If there's nothing else, the House Committee on Revenue will stand adjourned.
And adjourned.